Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 7, You Win or You Die. That's true of the podcasting game, too.
Yeah.
You win or you die. There's no throne. There's no real cool, like, sword throne to sit on, or microphone throne.
There's a porcelain throne.
there is that,
I do hold court there at various times during the day.
Yeah, but I feel like Tywin's not a guy who'd sit on a porcelain throne.
Maybe he should avoid privies, outhouse. Actually.
Yeah.
I also think that maybe Cersei should watch, was it War Games?
War Games with Matthew Broderick?
Yeah, get the Whopper's philosophy in there. Just don't play.
Oh, right.
It's not a binary option, Cersei.
There is a third choice?
Yeah, you can do... There's other options besides fucking the drunken king and your brother. Like, it's always black and white with this woman. What's going on?
Yeah. Well, what'd you think of this episode?
I actually was really blown away by how good this episode was. And it might be that I've spent... like 2 weeks away from Game of Thrones, or just like, you know, absence makes the heart fonder or whatnot. But like, I just was really pleased with, and remembering like my initial reactions to it and how kind of shocking everything was at the end. But yet when I'm watching it a second time, how inevitable it all felt.
Yeah.
It really wasn't like, you know, when she tears up that pardon or the king's decree and she goes, oh, a paper shield, Ned Stark. I'm like, oh fuck. Yeah. How stupid.
Right.
But like when he got that and changed it, I'm like, oh, this is Ned playing the game. You know what I'm saying? The first time I'm like, oh, he's being crafty there.
Yeah, and the second time through, like Littlefinger's betrayal is telegraphed. I mean, the scene between him and Ned in Ned's whatever it is office.
Right, yeah.
You can just tell Littlefinger, he's trying to convince him of one thing, Ned says no, and then Littlefinger's like, well, okay.
And then literally everyone is telling him, this is the worst of all outcomes you're pursuing.
Right, and Renly, everyone.
Littlefinger, even Cersei
uh-huh.
is saying these things, and it just doesn't penetrate his understanding of how the world should work.
Yeah, he's got this shell of honor that that's just nothing gets through.
Sure. I thought it's great, and there's just some epic, iconic scenes. Like you get peak Drogo, in this.
There's
also like some of the sex position right. is really like I remember being kind of a staunch defender of it, like you know, because it was all kind of new information. Mm-hmm. But now it's just like it goes on for so long, and it's so gratuitous, and love Roz, she's my favorite gal. not going to complain about seeing her, but man, that scene goes on for a long time.
It does, yeah. Littlefinger gives a whole speech and everything.
And fucking we meet Tywin Lannister, played by Charles Dance, and he's just incredible the way he
deals with the intensity of that performance.
And we've been conditioned to kind of hate the Lannisters, and then you meet the head of the family, and it's like, oh, right, this is why they're ballers.
Yeah.
This is why they run shit, because like you look at Ned, you look at Robert, and then you look at Tywin, and even if, you know, he's literally carving up a stag, he's literally, you know, going at the Baratheon Empire here, he's the one that's like, okay, this actually makes a lot of sense, what he's saying.
Yeah, and it's
nuanced.
I agree, and it's actually really interesting when you juxtapose it with Ned, who's kind of the other house leader here. The other father figure who has the same responsibilities as Tywin to, you know, carry on the legacy there, but he views it completely differently.
And it's funny because he says, like, I don't want any bloodshed, like, in this room. But multiple people point out that you are going down a course that's going to wash the kingdom in blood.
Right.
Like, taking this to Stannis and calling your banners is going to lead to deaths of thousands, if not tens or hundreds of thousands, yet... Yeah. He's really concerned about dragging children from their beds and not spilling any blood in the royal throne room. It's just so funny to see a second time through. But no, I thought it's great.
Yeah, me too. Why don't we get into the recap?
Let's do it.
We start off with Jaime visiting his father with the message that he's to report to King's Landing, answer for his crimes, all that stuff about the mountain we heard last episode. Mm-hmm. Tywin tells Jaime to toughen up and gives him half their forces to go take back Tyrion because the reputation of and legacy of their house is at stake here. And Tywin sees that.
And is Tywin wrong with any of... I mean, if you are the lord of a great house, mm-hmm. what is the that he's saying is wrong? That, like, you know, it's not about my personal honor or our dignity or our fortune or fame. It's about our family name and the difference between opinion, like you are the Kingslayer versus a yep. fact, which is
they'll lose respect.
Yeah, like that's like if we let someone hold them with impunity, that does real damage to our reputation because it either says we're mentally weak that we won't contest it, or we're physically weak, we're unable to contest it.
Right.
And like just how smart he is from both a tactical, a strategic, and a diplomatic angle.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a politician.
Yeah.
He's also a politician with a sword. Don't get me wrong. It seems like he's a capable warrior as well, but first and foremost, he's a politician.
And there's like so many cool character details. Like he is this great lord.
Yeah.
He has any dozens and hundreds of people who can carve up venison for him.
Yeah.
But he's doing it himself. I mean, he might have taken this deer himself. He's going to carve it up. He's going to dress it. That says a lot. And you know, like I guess you'd call this carnivore's position, like. Just like, okay, instead of having Littlefinger just speechify in front of a mirror, have him speechify in front of two whores that are going town on each other.
Right.
Like,
says a lot about him.
He could this could have just been a scene over a dinner table, but having Tywin just going at this deer and dressing it says a lot about his character.
Yeah, I think so. And a lot of that comes through because of, I'm going to call him Chuck D. That's what I call him, Chucky D.
Yeah, sure.
Charles Dance's performance in this scene. I mean, there's an intensity on his face where every word that comes out of his mouth you take seriously.
So the first time I've ever seen Charles Dance, he plays the googly-eyed, weird assassin from The Last Action Hero.
Hmm.
The kind of Arnold
Schwarzenegger. I'm not sure I've seen that movie, actually.
Okay, so it's a an Arnold Schwarzenegger parody, except for it's not really a parody.
Okay.
It's like a what-if movie. Like you get
Is Sinbad in it? That's what I want to know.
No.
Okay, that's why I never saw it.
It parodies a lot of like action hero tropes and stuff, but I don't know. I've always had a soft spot. I saw it when I was like 13. Thought it was pretty great.
Yeah.
I've seen him in a lot of stuff since, but he does have this way of playing this. Like, it would kind of suck to have this guy as your father.
I would think so.
Because it's not just that nothing you do is good enough, but... I mean, it's like I get the impression this man has never made a mistake in his life.
Or at least he thinks he's never made a mistake.
Or if he knows, he's probably... That's the thing, is that I think he has made mistakes, and he probably knows it because he's got a pretty realistic view of his own capabilities, but no one else does. Like, he makes mistakes and probably goes, and when he's viewing the tape, like, oh, I could have gotten 1,000 horses out of that deal instead of 900.
Right.
But it's not, you know, that's just, you know, you'd have to be Tywin Lannister to see the mistakes he's making.
Sure.
I can't believe I'm giving this much blowjob to Tywin Lannister, honestly. He's a fucking Lannister.
Sure. But he's the most impressive of the Lannisters.
Did you feel about this way about... Tywin, I mean, because I kind of felt like that this was the point where Game of Thrones starts to become the three-dimensional good guys don't always win thing that, like, up in this point, because I was completely ignorant. I heard of Game of Thrones, but, you know, I was just watching the series week by week. I hadn't read the books. And I was thinking, okay, well, I can kind of see how this season's going to go down. It's going to be this epic confrontation between the Starks and the Lannisters.
Uh-huh.
This is the episode where you start to find out the Lannisters, like, oh, it's not just, you know, everyone likes Tyrion. You can at least admire Tywin and see the truth of his words.
Mm-hmm.
And also the good guys might not win this one.
Yeah. No, I mean, the betrayal of Ned is certainly surprising. And you're right about the three-dimensionality of it. It feels like a real world.
Right.
It doesn't just feel like a made-up TV world.
Yeah. It's not Darth Vader and Grand Admiral or Grand Moff Tarkin talking about torturing a princess and blowing up the world.
Sure.
Let's disband the Senate and fuck everyone. It's like, hey, these are the realistic concerns, and this is a natural reaction we're having to the movements of our enemies, who are the Starks.
Yeah. Makes sense. Is this a real animal that he's cutting up here, do you know, that he's skinning?
I do not know. I don't know.
Because if not, man, it's a hell of a prop.
It really is. I know they've addressed this because I think that Charles Dance actually did a commentary, and I didn't have time to watch it. Mm. But I know that it's been addressed. I know the answer is there, but I have no idea.
Okay.
I don't think he knew how to dress a deer. Because I think
in the scene while they were filming,
yeah, like that. This is something that, like, you know, that he kind of learned enough to do, like, okay, stage carve a deer.
Right. Yeah,
it's not like he's like from a proud tradition of hunters. Maybe I get that wrong, sure, too. I don't know anything about Charles Dance.
Okay. We move on to Ned confronting Cersei about her relationship with Jaime.
Wait, before we move on, the other thing about Tywin is just when you think, like, oh, he'd be a merciless son of a bitch to be the son of, or to be the one of his children. At the end, when he grabs Jaime by the neck and says, I need you to become the man you were always meant to be. That's why, like, yes, it would be so harsh and uncompromising to be his child, but also that's why you always want to make him happy. Because at the very end, you know this great man sees greatness in you, and you don't want to disappoint him.
Right.
So it's like Jamie's really in between these pinchers. Like, I trust, like, I've talked a bunch of shit about you, but even still, you're a Lannister. You're destined for greatness. Here's 30,000 men. Don't fuck up.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're going to fuck up.
And specifically, he says, you know, you've been given all these advantages.
Yes.
And to date, you haven't done anything with them, but...
Right.
That's part of you. You need to do it now.
Which, like, even within his family, he's an expert diplomat. It's crazy.
Sure. So Ned confronts Cersei about her relationship with Jaime. She doesn't try to hide it, actually, which is really strange to me. And then Ned says that he's going to tell Robert when he returns, and that Cersei is to leave the city before then. Cersei, you know, threatens him with the you win or you die stuff.
Right.
Which becomes pretty, even extra ominous at the end of this episode when he's taken prisoner. Why does she admit so freely what's going on here? She doesn't try to deny it in any way.
I actually think that she, if I'm reading everything correctly, I think that she already knows what Ned knows, and these plans are already underpath.
Because Jon Arryn found out, and presumably, sure, Cersei might have been involved in killing him.
Right.
So you got to think, yeah, he followed that path as well.
Yeah,
she's just assuming a lot.
And with
here,
all the spies that, you know, that
still, like. I don't know why she would ever admit it to anyone, even if they have her dead to rights. Like, deny, deny, deny. That's the strategy here.
But
right?
On the other hand, I think that this is Cersei. That, like, you know, this is a three-dimensional world, and we're seeing that Cersei is not quite the Machiavellian, you know, overlord that Tywin is,
sure,
because she did make an unforced error, which is, and you know, we will see what comes of it. But Ned Stark gets off a message to Stannis.
Yeah.
Saying, like, all the, you know, all this, talking all this shit about the fact that Jaime and Cersei are still sharing a womb, so to speak.
Right.
So I think that shows that early on, all the Lannisters, it's really cool how they're showing, like, the difference in Jaime and Cersei and Tyrion. And then we see Tywin, who kind of has, like they're almost like a, all three different aspects of him split off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cersei got all of his pride and his arrogance. Jaime got, like, a lot of his martial skill and his wit. And then Tyrion got the smarts and not much else.
No,
yeah.
Nothing.
And half as much as the others on everything else. So yeah. I think that's really cool.
Do you agree that it was a mistake for Ned not to take the throne when he had the chance?
Well, so this is the first time we've actually gotten this information in the show, I think. I know we talked about it in the spoiler section that Ned, when he came during the sack of King's Landing, he found Jaime sitting on the Iron Throne and said, "Get the fuck off."
Yeah.
I don't know.
But didn't claim it for himself.
I remember there was a lot of talk in the first seasons about what if. And I feel like that Ned would have made a pretty terrible king in his own right. They would have been completely different mistakes.
Sure.
But they would have still ultimately probably plunged the realm. Because the thing is, Ned, we already know that Varys is working with Illyrio to destabilize the realm.
Mm-hmm.
Varys is way fucking smarter than Ned. We know that Littlefinger is working to get everything in this episode. Littlefinger is way smarter than Ned.
Yeah.
You know, Robert pardoned all of the loyalists that he defeated. Ned counseled to destroy or to either disgrace, banish, or destroy them. What would that have done to an already fret? Like, maybe this stuff happens 20 years earlier.
Imagine how many advisors there'd be in Essos right now.
Right.
If he had banished
everyone
in the kingdom.
Exactly. Like, anyone with a grudge against Westeros is going to be scheming in Essos. And yeah, I don't know. Like, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you largely. I don't think he would make... I think he would make a just king and probably a good ruler in peace times, but I think he would be ousted from the throne immediately.
Yeah.
Like, he would probably just be killed.
I think the small folk would love him.
Yeah.
Because he probably would stick up for them, and, you know, he's kind of humble and the rough spun and and all that. It'd be kind of like a Nebraska farmer being president. Like, you know, a lot of people could say, okay, well, he's salt of the earth and whatnot. Or peanut farmer. He's Jimmy Carter.
Okay, right.
Winter's coming. We all need to wear sweaters. Turn down our thermostats. You know,
build houses.
Only so much dragon fire to go around. I just don't think he would have been a very effective king.
Yeah.
Very few people are.
Sure. Okay, let's move on. Littlefinger teaches Roz and another one of his new whores how to do their jobs in a graphic sex scene here. Gratuitous, not super graphic. The topic.
I love it. The middle. He's like getting it now. Do butt stuff.
Okay.
I don't know. This is really funny. Play with her butt what did he say?
I don't remember.
It's like, okay, things are taking a turn. Things are being flipped up and reversed.
The topic of Catelyn comes up, and Littlefinger tells a related story of a duel and how he kind of learned how to get what he wants. He needs to, you know, be himself.
Right.
And that's, you know, and then Roz finishes this girl off.
And this is all, there's a lot of stuff being told, but one of the blatant things is this is a metaphor for his relationship with Ned. Right? The
what
fact
is?
That you ease into it, the, you know this is an act and they don't trust you, but it takes time to make him forget.
Right. Yeah,
and
yeah.
He wants to believe you and he wants to think that he's this great man that's navigating these corridors of power, and everybody subscribes his because Littlefinger is kind of like the ultimate whore.
Mm-hmm.
He's doing this for money and power, and he'll do or say anything to get it. So that it works on that level. So that's what I'm saying. Like, I think people dismissing this as purely sex position are off the mark, but on the other hand, it is pretty fucking gratuitous. And then also, we get a lot of backstory from Littlefinger that would otherwise just be kind of some dry conversation that might not even be plausible.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing, knowing Littlefinger a little bit better and having a better handle on his character, does it seem like him that he would spool out intimate details of his past to his whores? That's the only thing that kind of bugs me as a seasoned veteran watcher.
That's a little strange. I mean, I guess I'm taking all this at face value and saying it's true.
I guess none of these things could hurt him because all the lords and ladies of the land would know this story already.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how much of his like affection for Catelyn does he reveal here? Quite a bit, yeah? I mean, it's not just like, oh, we grew up together and there was a duel. Like, historical fact, it's more like his feelings, which is strange for Littlefinger to unveil.
That's true, and the current state of them, because I know we've debated in the spoiler section and maybe even on the podcast about, like, where does he stand with Kat right now?
Yeah.
And if you take him at his word, which I kind of do, I think this is a fairly unguarded moment, he's always speaking of his affection and his love for her in a past tense.
But he's also saving himself for another.
Right.
Is what he says, which I have to think is bullshit.
Well, but he also says that she's not attractive. Like, I don't know how you come down on Catelyn Stark as played in the series, but I think she's a handsome woman.
She's not bad looking, sure.
No. So he's I feel like when he says another...
And impeccable bloodlines. I mean, my God.
And she's got impeccable bloodlines. So we're looking for someone who I don't think is Kat. And just even when he's phrasing, I'm saving myself for another, I still don't think he's talking about Kat, because that another is in contrast to the woman that he talks about as a youth, which was clearly Kat. And that he's kind of humiliated and now he wants to fuck him. And by doing that, he's going to be betraying Ned. I feel like that, whatever love you felt for Catelyn is like, that was a formative, that's basically a, you know, don't trust bitches kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know,
sure.
And this is he's been listening to Jay-Z. He's got Big Pimpin' on repeat on his iPad or iPod, and he's just not going to make that mistake again.
Yeah, it's you know, he's the minstrel of the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's roaming the land singing songs.
Right,
about
as the great poet once wrote, "Yeah, thug 'em, fuck 'em, love 'em, leave 'em,
right.
But you don't ever feed 'em."
Nope. There's just not a lot of food to go around in that world.
Right.
So Theon plays with the new wildling girl and kind of tries to fuck her. I don't know. Master Luwin walks in and puts a stop to it, embarrassing Theon. And then Luwin asks why the wildling girl is so far south. She says they were trying to get away from some evil shit up north that has awoken.
Hmm. I love this scene because it shows someone changing the fucking rushes. In the books, there's two things you get a lot. You get a lot of beer and grease dripping from beards, and you get a lot of rushes. Like those reeds that she's carrying on her back.
Uh-huh.
Apparently, in medieval times, they didn't have wall-to-wall carpeting. And, you know, bare stone or bare dirt floor is cold. So what they'd do is they'd spread these fragrant, like, reedy rushes on the floor. And they'd have to be changed all the time because they'd go bad. It's literally like the way you do a hamster cage. You put that shit down that smells nice, and then you have to change it frequently. They're actually showing someone changing the rushes. And this is something that's probably mentioned 100 times in the books.
What the hell? Yeah.
I know. And it's like,
it's just a passing detail.
I know, but I loved it so much. Like, she's fucking changing these are rushes, and she's changing them.
I've never even heard that term. Okay. Yeah.
Well, like I said, you need to read the books.
Yeah.
What I like this detail we get about Asha.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she's smarter than Theon. Like, she's given him the business in such a way that he's not even sure he's getting the business.
Yeah, and I don't know. The family stuff here, like, when Theon's like, oh, my father is Balon Greyjoy, right. Lord of the Iron Island, whatever right. the hell he says.
Yeah.
And she's like, what's that got to do with you?
Yeah.
It's like,
when he dies, I'll be the Lord. So you're not Lord now? Why should I?
Right. But when you tie this back to like Tywin's conversation with sure. Jaime, where Jaime hasn't really done much and right. all that matters is the legacy, and just like, Theon's not doing anything either.
Yeah.
He's kind of like Jaime in this situation, except maybe even less so.
And you know what? It would really piss Theon. If I had to bet money on it, I bet Asha's heard of the Lannisters.
Yeah,
you know
probably.
Saying?
I bet word makes its way up north.
Yeah, like there's, you know, you might not know everybody from different countries and stuff, but mm-hmm. like, you know, you've heard of the big, like everyone's heard of the Windsors and Queen Elizabeth. Everybody's heard of the Bushes and the Clintons. Like the Balon is, I know what would he be?
The Kim Jong-il, I don't know.
He'd be like the Midwest's largest McDonald's franchise owner,
okay.
right? That's
yeah.
Balon Greyjoy. No one's heard mm-hmm. of like, you know, up against, no, yeah, we've heard of Lannisters. They pay their debts. They shit gold.
Yeah, that's like the CEO of IBM or something,
right? Yeah. I never heard of you, man. and also they have this thing where Luwin comes in and bangs this, you're a prisoner, boy, thing
yeah.
home with him again.
Mm-hmm. Same as her.
That's pretty great. I think this is peak Theon looking goofy scene. This guy is just like his beard, his
mop hair,
patchy and going every which way.
Yeah.
He hasn't combed his hair in 3 days. His eyes are at his buggiest and
yeah.
kookiest.
Mm-hmm.
Like him and Remy Malek from Mr. Robot need to get together and have a Google off.
Right.
Who can protrude their eyeballs out further from their skull?
Who's the lady on David Letterman who could do that like a long time ago?
Like a stupid
just
human
like,
trick?
Yeah, pop her eyes like right out of socket.
Okay.
Just practically dangling from the optic nerves. It was disturbing.
So leaving her out of the competition,
well, yeah.
I think, I don't know. Just on this scene alone, I think Theon might be able to out-Google old Mr. Robot.
Also, I get the impression that this wildling girl could fuck Theon up.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Theon's great with a bow.
Right.
But up close, she's going to tear your throat out.
And also, he doesn't respect her at all.
Yeah.
So, like, yeah, like, it's a good thing Luwin came and saved him,
yep.
her or him from her, because it seems like she'd just chew him up and spit him out. I also like the fact that she's saying, like, you know, we meant to get further south than this, which, mm-hmm. like, from last episode, I'm like, yes, you did. You shouldn't, like, why the fuck were you thinking about extorting goods and stuff from the lords when you should just be hiking it?
Yeah.
Winterfell is not south, despite what you think. You need to keep going.
Sure.
Like, keep going until you can wear a bikini. And then find a beach and stop there. Like,
uh-huh.
there's still fucking snow on the ground at this place. You're not far enough south.
Agreed. We move on, speaking of snow, to John and Sam, who are on the wall. They're up top when they spot a riderless horse running toward the gate. They let it inside, and John identifies it as his Uncle Benjen's horse, but Benjen's nowhere to be found.
Yep.
I really love Sam in this scene. I mean, Sam's one of my favorite characters.
Ladies' man.
Period. Right? He's like, it's so sad, because Sam really misses the girls. He liked to hear them giggle. What he doesn't probably realize is they were giggling at him.
He doesn't care. It's a musical sound.
Right.
Sound.
He doesn't care. He's so used to it by now that he's just like, oh, it's a nice sound.
Sure.
Poor Sam. Let's move on to...
Did we talk... They established that's Benjen's...
They did, yeah.
Okay, so that's his uncle's horse come out riderless. Mm-hmm. That's not good.
No, not at all.
Especially with knowing how this whole season began. What's up there north? Like, what's poor Benjen?
Yep. So we go to Renly fetching Ned to Robert's bedside. He's been gored by a boar and he's dying. Robert sends everyone out of the room and has Ned write up a document making Ned Lord Regent until Joffrey comes of age. And he also has a change of heart on this Dany thing. He tells Ned, stop the plan to kill her if it's not too late. And then Ned steps outside and Barristan kind of, you know, is lamenting that he couldn't protect the king, and then Varys wonders aloud, oh, I'm sure Lancel feels real bad about that whole wine thing and giving him too much wine. And then Ned tells Varys to stop the hit on Dany, but he says no, too late.
What's your stance on this Lannister deal? Because I thought this could be Varys fucking with Ned and send him on a wild goose chase, because, you know, we saw in previous scenes how Lancel was always being berated for letting Robert's cup run out. So if I'm his squire and I'm gearing up for a big boar hunt and I'm just trying to do a good job, or even if I don't give a shit about the king, I'm trying not to get, like, you know, thrown into the black dungeons or put to death or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to keep his cup filled.
Right. That's why I think it works so well in the show, because you don't really know.
Right.
Like, maybe Lancel did it. Maybe Lancel just gave him too much wine.
Right.
Maybe Lancel poisoned him. Maybe Varys is behind the whole thing. Who knows? Right.
Maybe Barristan should have said something like, you know, of course Ned says you couldn't protect the king from himself, but maybe Barristan should have taken Lancel and said, hey, the king's had enough.
Yeah.
Start mixing this with water, like, oh, you know, he's not going to know the difference.
Wine and coffee.
Wine and coffee. right.
I like when they're in Robert's bedchambers here, and Cersei's still there, and she's looking at Ned, and Ned has just threatened, look, as soon as he gets back, I'm going to tell him all about this, and that is on Cersei's face.
Right.
And on her mind.
Oh, yeah.
And then when she gets sent out of the room, she kind of does a hesitant...
But Robert, my sweet.
Uh-huh.
You know, I might need to stab Ned real quick, and then I'll be out of the room.
yeah, so I picture her, like, leaving that room and sprinting down the hall to make arrangements.
Sure, she's getting on. She's on her phone to the Gold Cloaks and to Littlefinger, and she's trying to summon her banners, such as they are.
Yeah, and Littlefinger is suspiciously absent from all this commotion here,
yeah,
which
Varys
makes me wonder if maybe Cersei and her,
here.
Or Cersei and him, aren't
That's
meeting
the whole
up
small,
right now.
This is the whole small council minus
Littlefinger. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the fix is in from that point.
Yeah.
I also like that, like, when we come in, Robert's trying to comfort Joffrey, who actually is moved. No, he thinks this is his father.
Sure.
But Robert's like, I wish I'd spent time with you so you weren't such a fucking shit.
Right.
I didn't know how to be a man. I didn't teach you. You're no man. Like, he's just
now.
Talking.
Now leave the room, Ned. Yes. Ned, my son's a shit, and he's useless. Fix him.
Yes. I mean, like, if you're Joffrey,
yeah.
Like, Joffrey's a shit, but I think he comes by it honestly when you look at his parents.
He does. Yeah. Robert's never around.
No.
He's not teaching that kid anything.
Well, if he is, it's something. It's all bad.
Yeah. How to pour a cask of wine into a goblet.
How to smack your wife around and she gets lippy.
Yep.
How to whore on her. Yeah, it's all bad.
I think it was last episode you were saying in the spoiler section that you thought Robert came around on the Dany thing, but in that episode he didn't, and you were like, okay, well, I guess he doesn't. Here he does. He finally, on his deathbed, he's like, this is a mistake. Call it off if you can, Ned.
What? So, I don't know, how much stock do you put in deathbed conversions or confessions?
Not a ton.
Right.
Not a ton. I think, you know, that's a time of extreme stress. And
that's what I'm saying.
It fractures otherwise clear-headed thinking.
Like, I know there was a lot at the time, and I'm pretty sure it's probably bullshit, but people saying that, like, Carl Sagan...
Right.
Converted to Christianity on his deathbed. Like,
probably because he said, oh, God, I'm dying or something. Like,
you know, and if he did, like, I don't think that would, like, oh, well, I can't be an atheist anymore. One of my heroes convert. Like,
Yeah.
You know, when you're staring into the abyss, like, and also maybe that's just like if he did, I don't think he did. Mm-hmm. I don't have time to Snopes it. But, like, that's a rational move. If, like, one of your last conscious thoughts, you want to throw a dice in Pascal's right. wager, why not?
Uh-huh.
You know, you're standing before the void. You know, say a couple Hail Marys.
Yeah, because the only reason Pascal's wager doesn't work out is because you have a life to live.
Yeah.
If you no longer have any choices right. in front of you, just boom, pick one and go.
The other problem with Pascal's wager is which god. You know, there's lots sure. of problems with Pascal's wager. But I'm saying is like...
But on your deathbed, those go away. Those
yeah,
melt
like
away.
Like fear and like, you know, the whole no atheist in a foxhole. Well, what yeah. the hell does that even mean? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, people do a lot of crazy, stupid stuff in extreme moments of stress and emotion. So
right.
I don't... So him dying and maybe it's like also you could look at it for like he's Ned's friend and he's just talked about what a difficult thing this is to be for Ned. And maybe he's like, you know what, Ned, I don't want you to think that you have to pursue something that you don't agree with out of my memory. Like you just be your own king or your own
okay.
king.
Giving him permission to do the things he knows he's going to do anyway.
Yeah.
And like, not feel guilty about him.
Yeah. Like it's like he's releasing Ned from any kind of obligation. So there's right. a lot of ways you could take that. And I don't sure. know. Which it seems like in life, Robert was not going to come around on it.
Yeah. Okay, let's go over to Essos. We get a scene of Dany braiding Drogo's hair while she tries to convince him to take the Iron Throne. He doesn't seem to care about the throne at all. Later, she asks Jorah for help convincing him, but he doesn't seem to think that they can do it without dragons. And by it, I mean take the throne.
The other thing is, I remember when I was first watching this and they're talking about chairs and dirt, I'm like, God, are they, like, they're speaking their own language. Why are they just, like, using all these weird pigeon terms? And then Drogo corrects her, lands, not dearth, or not dirt. And I'm like, oh, okay. I forgot Dany's still learning to speak this language. You know what I'm saying? It's like, I thought they were making, like, downplaying.
Oh, really? See, I went the other way with it. Like, Drogo would have called those places dirt, but...
But he did correct her to like, up to we Dany. Actually have the concept of sovereign places beyond...
right,
know?
But I thought he's saying your homeland is not dirt. Your oh. homeland is a land. Like, he's showing her some respect
oh,
here.
Oh, no, okay.
And showing that they're kind of warming up to each other a lot more.
Gotcha. No, I mean, this is where, like, when people start talking about the romance of Dany and Drogo, yeah. they're talking about these episodes.
Right.
Because the whole Moon of My Life and My Sun and Stars and all that...
Sure.
It is pretty fucking romantic.
And, you know, professing to take all of Westeros for her.
Right.
Well, I guess technically for his kid.
Right. Yeah, not but her. It's for her. Like, in this moment.
She wants the throne. He's going to get it for her.
But that's the thing. Like, I remember, like, when I was first watching this, like, man, you need to pump the brakes because it's a short walk from request to nag. And I don't think Drogo is the kind of guy you want to just nag for the throne.
Sure.
But... You know, it works out. Like, you know, this threat to her life was the lever she needed to move him off his position of like, ah, fuck Westeros.
Yeah, it sure is.
But, yeah, I just, I don't know. This is another pretty great scene, I thought. And
yeah, it is. And Jorah, you know, afterward explaining kind of how the throne was taken the first time by the Targaryens. They did it with dragons. They don't have any dragons anymore, so... Mm-hmm. Good luck taking the throne.
And also Jorah being kind of even skeptical about dragons. I thought that was
yeah, a little.
An interesting choice. The fact that, like, you know, that's something in Dan Carlin's latest Hardcore History. He's talking about how, you know, we take as gospel statements from historians in ancient times, like 2,500 years ago, on statements that they... were talking about that happened 300 years before their time. And
right.
he's like, that's... bizarre when you think about, like, you know, how much information we have about stuff that happened 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and how things are hotly contested, but yet we tend to, when antiquity, it's like, oh, this guy says this thing, Herodotus, so he's got to have it right, because uh-huh. he's still three, what kind of sources did they have, you know,
right.
and what kind of legends, and so here's Jorah like, they said they took the land with the dragons, but I don't know, I haven't seen a dragon, that could be bullshit. Like, I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's fair. And then he sneaks off and finds one of Varys' birds, who hands him a royal pardon.
Mmm.
And they call Varys the spider. Have they called him the spider before?
Yeah, because Varys was saying, like, oh, no one feels pity for the spider when he was doing his sad sack routine with Ned.
Right. Okay. We go over to Jorah watching as a wine merchant tries to give Danny some poisoned wine. Jorah tells him to drink it first, and the guy dumps it, runs off, and he's captured by the Dothraki. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, a little more extended scene there than just that. Danny looking happy for, like, maybe the first time I've seen her.
Yeah.
Smiling and just enjoying the market.
Yeah.
This, especially when this
her brother's or her asshole brother's dead, her husband loves her. Maybe she'll get all to go her home now. And she's got free wine. I'll take a case of free wine. What's not to smile about?
Yeah. I'm confused.
Okay.
Slightly confused. So where did Jorah's loyalties lie at this point? Like, now that he has his pardon, does he feel like he can kind of renege on the end of his deal?
I don't know. Because I, as several people, there's some feedback about this, but the crucial thing about Jorah and his spying is he's not spying on Danny initially. He's spying on Viserys, right? Because he's the one who's the king who wants to be returned, so he's not really, you know, and he's an easy guy to spy on. He's a complete asshole. He's a complete dumb fuck. Like, nobody wants to see him on the Iron Throne.
Sure.
Danny, you like Danny. Danny's attractive. Mm-hmm. Danny is, like, high-minded. She's, you know, she's younger, more innocent.
Yeah.
I think that this is where Jorah starts to feel some conflict. Like, oh, is one thing when I was keeping tabs on her idiot brother. The idea that, like, and maybe it's the idea that King Robert would still come after her. Like, he talks later, like, oh, well, of course he would come after her. But I wonder if he really believed that. Hmm. Like, okay, well, now, you know, Viserys is gone, so there's no more threat. But I don't know. What do you think?
Like I said, I'm kind of confused on his decision here to jump in and stop this.
I think this is the first instance where he feels some kind of love/loyalty towards Dany.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it probably has to do with that big old smile she's got.
Yeah.
Having a good time now. Anyway, with the induction ceremony at the wall goes on a little bit too long for Sam and John's taste, and they're talking about what positions they'll get. John thinks to be a ranger, Sam a steward. The Lord Commander allows John and Sam to take their vows as followers of the old gods, even though Sam is a very, very recent convert, as in just this very moment here.
Right.
Then he assigns the recruits their jobs. John ends up as a steward, and he's angry about it. And then Sam tries to explain that, look, you're just being groomed for better things. Lord Commander wants you as his personal steward. That's a good thing. Does everybody understand this? Does Alistair understand that? That smile on his face when he sees John as a steward, how dumb is Alistair?
Well,
Sam snuffs it out.
I thought that this, it out. This is more evidence for John being real dumb, because I remember even the first time I saw this, like, you can't see what an awesome, like, yeah, you're essentially going to be the squire to the Lord Commander.
Right. I wonder what Tywin would think of that, though. You've essentially been a glorified bodyguard for the Lord Commander.
You're an ass wiper for this old man. Right. I also think that Lord Commander Mormont kind of dug himself into a bit of a hole during his little speech where he's like, you know, John's sitting there in the audience. He's like, you came to us as poachers, outlaws, rapists, thieves, without friends or honor. And Jon Snow's in the background like, fuck you, bastard son of a gray. I have tons of lots of friends. And then, like, he's going to be made a steward, but it also shows that, like, how quickly John reverted back to type. Like, he's talking to Pip and Sam, who have become stewards, and he's talking about how shitty being a steward is, and how you're just a bunch of maids, and you're just going to I'm like, oh my god, and Pip rightly takes offense for it.
Yeah.
It's like, look, man, the only reason I'm here is because I'm so damn good looking. My voice is like honey and some lord wanted to fuck me. He wanted to put his finger up my butt and I said no.
Yep.
And now I'm here. It's even worse than the wagon wheel of cheese I supposedly stole from my sister.
Yep.
And then Sam's like, look, I might be fat and not good with girls and not know how the world works, but even I can see what's going on here. And, man, but John's just dumb.
Yeah, I guess Alistair's just as dumb, though, because that smile on his face.
I think Alistair sees the look on his face and smile. I think Because I wondered that too, and I think there's two things going on. Number one, he's doing it to piss off John, and he's sure. also seeing John's look on his face, and he's having a private smile at, oh God, this, you know, Lord Snow is as bad as dumb as I thought he was.
Okay. All right.
He's having a private joke that the fact that then it makes John madder probably makes him is even funnier. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you're just watching a guy hang himself with his own rope.
So I would say that in most cases, stealing, rape, murder, those things are probably all selfish acts, wouldn't you say? Wouldn't
okay.
you agree?
I thought you were going to say wrong. I'm like, I would like to hear your defense of when...
I also think they're wrong.
Okay.
But in most cases.
In most cases.
But they're also like selfish acts in most cases.
Sure.
So you're entrusting the protection of the realm to a bunch of selfish people who... I don't have, it seems to me, a lot of incentive to stay here and protect this wall because they've already committed crimes that are punishable by death.
Right.
And the punishment for desertion is death.
Right.
They're used to that, man.
Yeah, that's right.
Like, they can run off and just be
dice.
Like, well,
sure.
I was dead before. I'm yeah. dead now. What's the difference?
Yeah. This is like, you know, Bon Jovi wrote a song about that, right?
Is it
they're cowboys on real
alive?
Horses they ride,
I guess.
Yeah,
not Benjen doesn't ride a horse anymore.
Bon Jovi.
But I don't know, I guess I don't particularly think that this defense of the wall is all that tenable.
Well, and
like
that's,
this idea, the basic concept of it.
So that's a trope, right? The fact that you've got, you know, the Dirty Dozen and they're kind of a bunch of ne'er-do-wells or the Expendables,
sure.
but they come together and
right.
like they're more than some of their parts, and you got a guy like Lord Commander Mormon up there that's saying all the words, and like they start to, it's a trick, you know, you deprive men of enough, it's the way, you know, standard military indoctrination works. You throw
right.
them together, you dress them all the same, you feed them all the same shitty food, you give them all the same bad experiences, they band together and they're not loyal to anybody but themselves, but that's kind of what you need.
Mm-hmm.
I think that also Lord Commander Mormon's putting a brave face on it. Like he knows how decrepit the watch is. Him and Master Aemon just made a pretty heartfelt plea to Tyrion, like, can you get us some good men? We need some good men. We don't have enough to hold anything.
Right. So, the difference here between, like, you know, training a bunch of people for the military and training a bunch of people for the watch is
yeah.
they aren't all rapists, thieves, and murderers who are already under penalty of death.
But you like, wonder, like, what if King Robert took the black and he's the Lord Commander? He's like, y'all a bunch of shits. I should have spent more time teaching you how to do anything but be
right.
shits. But, you know, it's like a guy like Mormont can actually make people believe that maybe
so.
They're more than the primordial shit from which they came.
Okay.
But yet, your point's well taken. The Night's Watch is, I wonder if it'll become a plot point.
I don't know.
The fact that the Night's Watch is a bunch of criminals and ne'er-do-wells.
Maybe. So we go to Renly, who stops Ned in the halls to warn him that...
Are we just not going to comment on Sam wanting to be a wizard?
Sam wants to be a wizard?
Like, Sam is, like, there's a reason he's beloved amongst the fandom. Like, he's essentially...
Oh, right, he says that.
Yeah, he's...
When I was young, I wanted to be... Right.
Yeah,
okay.
He's essentially the outcast, kind of loser, nerd that the, you know, the fantasy book readers and D&D players, like, he's their Mary Sue, right? And he's
sure.
essentially saying it right here. Like, I,
yeah.
you know... I love Sam.
Yeah, I do, too. He's a great character, and he seems to have a good head on his shoulders, too. He understands things that are happening.
Sure.
As opposed to some people who would fly off the handle.
Right. I think Sam is how I would be at the wall.
Okay.
I'd miss girls. I'd miss my square meals and not getting beat for no goddamn reason.
Except maybe with the ability to swing a sword.
Yeah.
Sam's pretty pathetic in the combat department.
Sure.
So we go over to Renly, stopping Ned in the halls to warn him that Robert's decree won't stand once Cersei gets a hold of it. He urges him to strike now by getting Joffrey away from his mother. Renly claims, hey, I'd be a better king than Stannis. But Ned refuses to dishonor Robert with any shenanigans. And also, he thinks Stannis has the rightful claim on the throne, so he goes with that.
And here's where, like, Renly's no prize either, because he was... I think he might have been able to convince Ned until he could, like, but I could be just as good. I could be a better king. Like,
yeah.
Oh, God.
He should have let that conclusion come about naturally, I think.
Yes.
Let something other than Joffrey happen.
Right.
And then parlay that into something else in the future.
Like, okay, we need to bring Stannis in on this, but right now we need to do this.
Right.
And just keep to the, and then who knows what happens. But
yeah.
By playing the I could be a better king card, that just instantly turned Ned against you.
And he actually, it turns out, as we hear later, kind of had Littlefinger on his side. I don't think Renly knew this, but Littlefinger, like if Joffrey didn't work out or whatever, was willing to put Renly on the throne.
Sure.
So I think if he had just been a little more patient and not been like, I'd be a good king.
Right.
He might have had a chance at it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a three-dimensional world, and
yeah.
You know, Renly would if he could step forward and be the perfect king, and it would be a little too perfect.
Yeah, I agree. Instead of making Renly king, Ned writes a letter to Stannis and sends it off with a messenger. Littlefinger comes in, and Ned tells him Robert has no children, so Stannis will be the king when Robert dies. Littlefinger urges him to make Joffrey king, wed Sansa to him, and then, you know, be an awesome dude for the rest of his life. And if the secret ever comes out, then he can make Renly the king. But Ned refuses because Stannis is the rightful heir, and he petitions Littlefinger for the Gold Cloak's help. And Littlefinger's like, oh, sure, I'm the one who pays them. He doesn't really promise the help here so much as say, I pay them.
Yeah, they're personally loyal to me.
Yeah.
And also, you just talked a whole bunch of shit and rejected all my counsel, but still want to use me for what you think is an unsavory thing. You want me to buy off the city's protection.
And what I think is a bad plan.
Right. So why would I do the honorable thing when... so clearly Ned making all these unforced errors.
Yeah.
And I thought that, like, when Littlefinger, what he laid out was like, that's a pretty fairly cunning plan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is airtight. You've got multiple exits. You got multiple ways to steer the thing. Like,
Right.
That would be interesting.
It's why, despite Littlefinger being a shit and betraying some of the characters that I also like, mm-hmm. I still really like Littlefinger. It's because he gets it. He understands how to play the Game of Thrones, and that's kind of what I'm watching the show for.
Right.
I don't necessarily want to watch it just to see the good guys be honorable.
Right. Yeah. No, again, this scene is just really good.
Yeah.
And like Tywin, you got to respect Littlefinger because he does mm-hmm. know he's a good operator.
Yep. Anything else on that?
I felt like there was, but I can't think of it, so maybe we should move on.
Okay. John and Sam take their vows at a weirwood tree that's crying blood. Is that normal for weirwood trees?
Yeah, they got like the reddish sap.
Okay.
Now,
leaking from the eyes.
Presumably this face has been carved quite a long time ago, why it's still bleeding sap, but, you know.
Okay.
It's canon.
John's direwolf, Ghost, pulls an arm out of the woods. That's not great. Benjen's arm, you think?
Is it
the arm, one of those arms that we saw in the first episode?
John Benjen
arranged.
Is he back from being wanted? The results come back. You're wanted dead. I don't know. We'll have to see.
Okay.
I liked the Ghost like bounding out of the wall. That was really cool. And like,
yeah.
Just even Sam, like John having to help him to his feet, but then they just had this sincere like bro hug, and like then all the rest of the Night's Watch guys, like these grizzled people, and they're probably rapists and horse thieves, and they're like, "Daw," and then they do bro hug.
It's a moment of celebration for these guys. Like they're embarking on a lifelong new journey here.
Yep.
It's an important thing they've done and one to be celebrated. So
and then suddenly corpse meat.
Yeah.
Because it is Game of Thrones, after all.
Right. We go over to Jorah, describing to Dany how the Dothraki kill people. He also tells her that Robert will never stop trying to kill her, but that he won't succeed. He's not going to let him,
right.
Essentially. Drogo comes in, having heard what happened, and thanks Jorah for saving her by giving him a horse. He also pledges a gift to his unborn son, all of Westeros.
Mm-hmm.
Just, he's going to give everything to him.
Yep.
They ride out of the city with the assassin in tow.
And I like how awesome this scene is, because he's like, I will take my Khalasar west and cross the Poison Sea. And I'm like, yeah, Drogo, go. I will kill them in. Yeah, they fucking need to deserve it. Tear down their stored houses. Yes, do that, Drogo. I will rape their... Whoa.
Danny's like, what?
Hoss. Whoa, it's right. But I will take their children as slaves. This was a badass scene, and now you're ruining it. Yeah.
I couldn't help but notice that when I was watching it. That this is the perfect like Key and Peele Steel skit right here. Like, yes. you get Key playing Drogo. I
actually kind of think they've him up a little, I kind of think they've done a send up of this.
Oh, have they? Yeah. Probably so.
Yeah.
But yeah, that struck me too.
Because yeah, it's so like, this is what you want, and the music and all that, and yeah. like, and then
it's gone too far. Also, I'm wondering, like, so he says you can have any horse, take your pick.
Mm-hmm.
Can he have Droga's son, the stallion who mounts the world? You said any horse, man. You said any horse.
Well, I wonder what would happen if he asked for Drogo's personal horse.
Right. He said any horse.
Right. Right.
What about Danny's horse
that he gave her, silver, for
the wedding? Yeah.
I don't know. It'd be interesting because he made the stereotypical, like, you know, that's a lot in the Bible,
mm-hmm.
where like someone will be so impressed, like, oh, you can ask for anything up to half of the kingdom. Like,
right.
That's and always seems for someone's sensible.
Head, and
yeah,
then,
and it's like, oh fuck, is my friend's head? Or, yeah. Oh, it's like Jesus' friend.
This it's my really... daughter. She's the first one out of the tent. I really fucked this up.
Yeah, it's not good now. She's got to serve as a temple slave. What did I do?
Right.
But at least they put a limit on it. Drogo's like,
yeah.
any horse.
But it's just a horse.
That's true. He can get a better horse.
He can get more horses. But
I don't think the Dothraki are the type to respect logic puzzles.
No.
Like, of course I meant off. Not my horse.
Right.
And if you press the point, he'd just kill you. Like, well, I thought you were cool and you're an asshole now, Jorah.
Right.
I'm going to drag you behind my horse. Let's see how long, many miles you make.
Yep. This is a really cool scene, though. I do like it.
Mm-hmm.
We go over to Ned in the final scene.
We're not going to talk about... you know, we had some sexposition. Mm-hmm. Bounce it out with some wine merchant dick.
Oh, right. Yeah. They stripped him down.
Yep.
Tied him to a horse and made him walk.
Yep.
How and far that's you the think thing, he like, gets?
I thought being drugged behind a horse is pretty horrifying. And then I remembered, oh, shit, this guy's naked. Because, like, you might make it 9 miles, but your dick ain't.
No.
That thing is going to catch roll over on your twig back. Or a rock. Yeah. And I, you know, that's like, oh,
you yeah. gotta, you got to drag on your back.
All those opinions, like your nipples, they're first to go.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I just think human beings aren't balanced for being on their back. Like, it's like you're always going to fight the writing action. Yeah, I don't know.
MythBusters has done this.
Let's see. Let's drag Buster behind and see whether he stays on his ass or he bounces on his dick.
And whether he has a dick at the end. It's made of metal, though, so.
No, they would do
it's a cheat.
They would get ballistic gel and... and some tubing and, you know.
Right.
It would be a fully functional ballistics gel penis before they were done with it.
All right, let's move on to the final scene. Ned is informed of Robert's death.
Yes.
And Ned's presence in the throne room is requested. Littlefinger says the city watch is Ned's, and Varys says Renly took off. He's gone, long gone. And when Ned gets to the throne room, he sees Joffrey on the throne and Cersei by his side. He tries to reveal this decree from Robert saying he's the Lord Regent. But Cersei dismisses it. She just tears his paper shield in half. When Ned calls on the City Watch to back him up, they kill Ned's men and Littlefinger takes him prisoner. It's a real betrayal here. Exciting moment, too.
Poor Barristan. He's
stuck in the middle of it.
I remember thinking, like, man, this might be, like, a cool battle, because you got these Kingsguard as a wall, and Barristan, he's, like, he's all conflicted about what he should do, his loyalty to the past king versus, and he's not impressed with Cersei, and then, nope, it just comes down to, once again, the Northmen taking it up the rear.
Taking it in the south.
Yep.
Yeah, but it's a great scene to watch. I do, you know, as much as I hate to see Ned betrayed, it feels right at the end
of
this episode.
Like Littlefinger said, I did tell you not to trust me, man.
He straight up said that.
Right.
And Ned did, so.
And all the warning, flashing red signs that he drove past in this episode on his way to his own betrayal. Like, he just...
I love the look on Joffrey's face when he whips out that decree.
Right.
Joffrey can't believe what's happening. He's like, this was my moment.
Yeah.
I'm on the throne. Can you people not see this? And now it's all going to be taken away.
Yes.
For like 2 years until I come of age.
Yeah. Can you imagine like a guy like Joffrey who's a shit and he probably doesn't know much about anything. And he's like, his mom's propped him up and said, hey, you're going to be king now. And he's doing all this. And Ned whips out this letter and says, nah, you're not even a rightful. That's gotta be.
Yeah, it's insulting, it's humiliating, it's
And it, to disheartening. His, to his eyes, it looks like just a blatant cowardly trick.
Sure.
Right?
I mean, Ned wrote the fucking letter.
Yeah. And he also played fast and loose with the contents thereof.
He did. So, yeah, it looks all sorts of bad coming from Ned.
That's the thing. Like, Ned still, like, it'd be interesting if he went to this end completely on the straight and narrow. Mm-hmm. But he bought off the gold cloaks. He changed Robert's words. Now, you know, it's like, it seems like he really got caught in this, like, I've got to do something to uphold my friend's wishes and what he would want if he knew everything, but I don't want to make a messy situation for... He just mm-hmm. tried to make square... You know, he tried to round off the square of his honor and his principles and wasn't true to any of them, and now look what happened to you.
Yeah. It is pretty clear to me who's actually in control here. I mean, if you look at Joffrey and you look at Cersei... Cersei's expression never changes.
Right.
She knows exactly what's going down here. She's the one pulling the strings, and Joffrey's just following her lead.
At this point, I know for a fact Cersei knows what's going to happen here.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, she's...
I mean, the way she looks at Janos, she, like, basically gives him the nod and says, yeah. Do this thing.
And when she rips up the hand, you know, that was a pivotal... Yeah. Because I thought, again, I was naive enough to think, well, he's got the paper.
Uh-huh.
Like, that's going to carry the day. Everybody's like, oh, shit, it's the king's words. Like, why? And it's so funny because Game of Thrones will devote 5 minutes to a scene to give the hero a weapon that just breaks.
Yeah.
Instantly when he tries to use it. And it's, you know, you're not used to its ways. It's a shock. It's a shock.
Indeed. Okay.
How do we get out of this situation? We will have to see.
Yeah, I guess so. It ends with a knife to Ned's throat, so... Mm. We'll see. That's it for the episode.
Hey, we're getting closer to the Rocket City NerdCon. If you don't know what that is, it is a big bash going on in Huntsville, Alabama, October 22nd, 23rd this year. You can get full details if you go to rocketcitynerdcon.org. And Jim and I are going to be headlining an event. We're going to be doing a lot of hosting a lot of panels. Going to be playing some fun games. We're going to play a version of like the old werewolf / mafia game where you know, a table full of Starks tries to suss out who's the fray trying to kill them in between rounds. We're going to play that in front of an audience. There's going to be some prizes awarded. We got other panels and events coming up too. We're going to have a booth. You can come and shake her hand or give us high fives or other, try to keep it, you know, it's a PG-13 conference. Try to keep it clean. We're bringing our giant Matt Damon. You can take a picture in front of the eighth wonder of the world, the giant Matt Damon face. Uh-huh. We'll have some merch that you can buy. We'll sign autographs. We'll flip quarters and for small stakes. Who knows what'll happen. But it's all going down in Huntsville, Alabama, rocketcitynerdcon.org. You can get passes for the whole weekend for $25 or $15 for the day. Again, October 22nd, 23rd. Hope to see you there. Now, you might be asking yourself, how did Jim and Aaron do it? They just sit around and watch television and podcast about it all day? Yeah, that's pretty much how it works around here. And we're fortunate enough to be able to do that because of the generosity of our fans, and a primary way they display that generosity is by signing up for our club at club.baldmove.com. You sign up for either $2 a month or $12 for the year. You get tons of bonus content. We have video shows accompanying most of our podcasts. We have Lunch with Jim and Aaron and On the Rocks with Jim and Aaron, where we talk about whatever you want to talk about. You can sign in live and ask us questions either through Twitter or to Google Hangout and interact with us. We've got VIP sections of the forums, ad-free feeds, combined feeds where you can get all of our shows in one feed, ad-free. All the kinds of stuff. We do video game playthroughs. We do this thing called Quit Your Pitching, where we pitch ridiculous television ideas to each other. All kinds of stuff. You can get the skinny at club.baldmove.com. And most importantly, it keeps us doing what we're doing because I'm not going to lie, we'd probably podcast without having because we did before for several years. We had full-time jobs. We did the podcast and wouldn't podcast as much.
Not nearly.
You wouldn't get 3 podcasts a week for Game of Thrones for damn sure. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't get a Mr. Robot if that. Other thing, This is not an ad so much as a, hey, this is something we're doing now. You're doing a new podcast.
Yeah, Halt and Catch Fire with Eric.
Doing a solo
personal
project.
Eric's fame.
Or you start a new band. It's a side project, not a solo
right.
project.
Yeah, it's not solo. Me and Eric are, we're starting in on season 3 of Halt and Catch Fire. We just did a preview cast for this season, and it starts up tonight, I think the episode airs.
I was going to say, have you seen it yet? Because I saw Steppenwall's advanced review, and he's talking it up really. I heard season 2 was a quantum leap over season 1, and he's saying stuff like all the minor problems they fixed in season 3. So, that's high praise.
Yeah, I'm excited for it. So, we'll be releasing those on Thursdays, I think. So, check those out if you watch that show.
New product.
Yep. Do we have some feedback to do?
We do. We do, in fact. Game of Thrones at baldmove.com is how you send us the feedback, or you can discuss it with your fellow fans at forums.baldmove.com. First up, this is kind of like supersized mailbag because we've essentially gone 2 weeks without dipping into it since we recorded the previous episode in advance. Tristan R. says, you've elaborated quite a bit on the passage of time in the show, yet I've never heard a discussion on the exact construction of the calendar in this universe. In our world, the calendar is designed to follow the passing seasons and reset after one complete cycle or year. In the Game of Thrones universe, the seasons last many years and the characters mention their name days. Not being a book reader, I'm ignorant of whether Gurm mentioned this minor yet crucial detail. Is 1 year in a showtime 365.25 days? I did a shit ton of research into this. I fell into a 45-minute discussion of solar cycles and lunar cycles and how many and why it take, the discrepancy between it takes 27 and a half days for the moon to orbit Earth, but the actual lunar cycle is 29.5 days because while the moon spins around the Earth, of course, is spinning around the sun, and the cycle is all about the shadow of the moon and how it's fucking ridiculously complicated. But one thing I found out right away is that the seasons do not a calendar make. Mm-hmm. A calendar is exactly how long it takes the Earth to revolve around the sun. Now, it just so happens because of the Earth's tilt that the winter and spring and summer and all that stuff coincide. But that's what Martin said, and I found a So Spake Martin. If you don't know what I'm talking about, there's this archive at thecitadel.org, which is this big, massive compendium of Game of Thrones lore, and they keep every correspondence or convention speech or whatever that George Martin's ever given for the last 20 years, Jesus. And it's called the So Spake Martin Archives. And he says, in a direct answer to a question, what is the cycle of a year? Why do they count years when the seasons are so strange? Martin said, 12 moon turns are in a year, just as on Earth. Even on our Earth, years have nothing to do with the seasons or with the cycles of the moon. Years simply a measure of the solar cycle or how long it takes the Earth to make one complete revolution around the sun. The same is true for the world of Westeros. Seasons do not factor into it. So there you go.
Sure.
He's also promised, because in part of my research, that I guess he's made comments in the past that the reasons the seasons are weird and not tied to the orbit of the sun will be made clear before the end of the series. But it's not, he says it's not going to have a cosmological or science fiction. It's going to be a magical answer. We might get some answers. And of course, he could change his mind at any time, and whether the show reflects that, who knows? But there you go. Good question, though. Jeff M., regarding the discussion of in the spoiler-free section on currency and its value, specifically in the show so far, currency, in volume more than Theon's next tumble since, has been mentioned 3 times. One was a debt conversation in the first small council meeting. That instance as a national debt of a country is a more abstract concept, so it doesn't set the value very much. However, in the context of the royal tournament for Ned's appointment as Hand, the tournament itself would have been awarded 40,000 gold dragons to the winner and 20,000 to the runner-up.
Whoa! So that 100 gold bet is nothing.
In the context of that, a bet for 100 gold dragons by a presumably rich noble is tiny.
Okay, I'll bet you a quarter that Ned Stark gets out of this. How about that?
Right? Okay. I don't know.
Let me think about it.
Yeah, I'll raise you 2 quarters.
And then you'll reveal my deepest, darkest secret when you lose the fucking bet. That's insane.
So Jeff had some interesting analysis of this. He says, I think the point of the dialogue was to foreshadow the open secret nature. that Renly's bedding of Loras represented and how it affects Renly's qualifications to start a dynasty as king.
Okay.
So I think he might be right there, that the small stakes reflects Littlefinger's kind of like, everybody knows you're gay, man.
Right. Oh, look, I've just revealed it.
Right, right. So
sure.
Okay. I thought that was pretty right on and interesting.
Yeah. Similar to Cersei's.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty open.
She's very open with it this episode.
Yeah.
Maybe disastrously so. Lily Stark said, I also just want to say, after watching the Khal Drogo scene, which gives me chills every damn time, that's a fucking crime that Jason Momoa was never a vocalist of a metal band. Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
sure,
yeah.
Like, especially a Dothraki metal band.
Sure. They ever make Metalocalypse, the movie?
Yeah.
They cast him as whatever. What is the fucking... God damn it. I watched the shit out of the show like 2 years ago and someone commissioned it and I've forgotten all about it.
I remember. Death Clock.
There's Murderface. I know he's got...
Right, yeah.
Yeah, anyway. Not going to make a joke that I can't actually articulate. Also, only because it came up again, I can't help but chime in here. Kit Harington did have a sort of slack-jawed thing going that I kind of noticed once you guys mentioned it. But what stood out to me most was the open-mouth thing Sean Bean does constantly.
Oh, really?
I'm not criticizing him. I'm not going to get crucified, and I honestly thought his acting is fantastic. Mm-hmm. But anytime he's not delivering lines, the guy's mouth is open. Maybe not slack-jawed, because that implies relaxed. It's more tense. Jaw like an anvil, as Littlefinger says later on. So maybe it's a deliberate choice. I'm just saying a bug could fly in there. You know what's weird is ever since this came up, I've become conscious of how often my mouth hangs open.
Mm. Yeah, you got to keep that shit shut, or people think you're dumb.
Well, so I might be a bit of a slack-jaw yokel. I did come from the hills of southern Indiana. So here's the thing. And I've never asked another human being this. I'm going to ask
you
as a representative.
Sure. I speak for all human beings.
Do you, when you're just sitting in a resting state, are your teeth touching or do they kind of float separated a bit?
I think they're separated a bit.
Okay, because I just realized, and I'm not talking about gritting your teeth, but like when my mouth is closed, my teeth are actually separated quite a bit. I find it uncomfortable to like hold them together like this.
Yeah, I wouldn't. Like especially when you're talking, I wouldn't hold your teeth together.
I wouldn't do that too. So like,
okay.
I don't know, but I've become aware that like a lot of times when I'm especially when I'm listening to someone talk, my mouth is sitting there like not like a gape,
right?
But like open. I don't know.
Huh.
I don't know.
I honestly can't tell you because now that you've said something, I can't like.
Do you think of me staying around my mouth? Okay.
No.
All right. Well, there you go. You've known me longer than probably anyone at this point. So.
Okay.
Adam H. This week's episode, you guys mentioned that Jason Momoa had his breakout role in Game of Thrones, and you guys hope he'll go on to do Aquaman permanently. What most people forget is that Momoa actually was a series regular on Stargate Atlantis, where he played as that series' main badass.
Like I said, had a breakout hit in Game of Thrones.
Shots fired on Siffy.
Yeah.
Siffy can't catch a break.
Nope.
Had it not been for Atlantis, I would not believe that he had gotten on Game of Thrones with such force, as his character in Atlantis honed his ability to play the strong warrior type.
Mm.
But everyone's forgotten he did that, and I think he's a newcomer to TV from Game of Thrones, which is false. Now, so that's a good question. Like, Katie Sackhoff?
Yeah.
Sackhoff. Mm. Would you say that Battlestar was her breakout role? Because to me, that implies that you then went on to set the world on fire.
Right.
If you get a major role in a minor show, and mm-hmm. I don't want the Battlestar fans to come at me, I'm just saying, like, in the pantheon of television and critical acclaim and all that, like, Battlestar,
sure.
Certainly important for the, you know, the fantasy sci-fi types, but larger culture, I wouldn't say it's breakout. I wouldn't say that's her breakout role. I would say that she attempted a breakout and rebounded, and the little shuttle thing couldn't catch her, and she went off bounds, and it
drifted into the sun.
Right.
Because I haven't seen her in much of anything since then.
Same with Jason. She's in Longmire.
Right,
but
she is.
There again, I wouldn't call that a breakout role, because that's very kind of a small-level hit. She, you know, like, if she went then played, like, Power Girl, I think, is the...
Power Girl?
That's the DC character who's like Superman or Supergirl, except she's got the massive tit window going in her costume.
Tit window?
Yeah.
I have never heard of this. Okay.
If she went on to play like Power Girl to some fame, then I would say that okay, you could look back and say that, you know, Longmire or Battlestar is a breakout role. But mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, the same is true of Jason Momoa. He's like, he did Conan and then I've kind of seen him in nothing. He's doing Aquaman now. Maybe that'll be big for him.
Yeah, like if Aquaman hadn't come around, I wouldn't say that even Game of Thrones is his breakout role.
Right.
I would say that was like a one or two hit wonder for him. But the dude is just so charismatic.
Right. It's like, what's his name? Chris what from Parks and Rec? Like his breakout role was Parks and Rec.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Like Chris, he became a star from Parks and Rec and then he is just blown up.
Like he's now this mega Harrison, like proto right. Harrison Ford type action hero, star.
Yeah. Just a generic, like across the board star. He can do it all.
I just feel like some of these guys are born in the wrong era. Like The Rock, imagine if he like was a major movie maker in the 80s.
Oh, man.
Or like Jason here. Yeah. These guys would have like been ruling. Like you'd talk about in the same breath as Arnold or Stallone. And they just,
yeah,
that kind of shit's become passe. I weep for it. I love that stuff, man.
Right.
I grew up when the 80s action heroes were in their primacy. So mm-hmm. anyway, Aquaman. I hope it works out for you, man.
Yeah.
Adam continues. Let's talk about King Robert. We talk about Robert plunging the throne into massive debt, whoring like a horny teenager. He's always goading Jaime Lannister, etc. Now, the last part is actually part of a bigger problem. Robert pardoned a whole buttload of people who had been Targaryen loyalists. Not only did he pardon them, but he also left them in positions that he found them in, like Randall Tarly, who actually was smart enough to be capable of defeating him in battle, leaving the Kingsguard basically intact, only replacing members who had died. He even kept the Kingsguard, who had slayed Aerys, right at his side, even leaving houses in power that sided against him, like House Tyrell. One could assume that he left them in their positions to maintain stability throughout the realm. However, there were many, both historically and in Game of Thrones, where the victors or powers that be put someone in charge of a region that was loyal to the crown. By leaving them in place, Robert surrounded himself with potential enemies, should any Targaryen rally enough support in the east to come over to Westeros. It leaves one to wonder, was he just too lazy to replace them? If not, then he just didn't care. Why leave potential traitors in charge instead of securing them? The Lannisters certainly had enough cousins to put people over every house. Not reading the books, Jim, what's your analysis of this position?
That sounds pretty fair to me, like that criticism.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, what happens when CEOs come into a company and kind of take over against everybody's wishes, and then
as a director level person who did not survive a company merger, it does seem like there's the purge of the old guard,
right?
Like that there's a lot natural. Of talk of, oh, we'll find the best fit, and everybody, but right. essentially these are my guys, these are the assholes we bought out, and
yeah,
you guys are showing the door.
That seems natural to me.
Yeah. I will say that from the books, it's essentially all these decisions were John Arryn's. He counseled leniency and returning the realm's stability and returning it to the king's peace over settling all these scores. And that's a very real politic kind of thing. Like, this is the same reason why, you know, the United States gets in this trap of like arming people that then we fight
right. yeah.
against 30 years. It's always like, well, would rather not have bloodshed now or let others do our fighting, and then it seems like you kick the can down the road and the can gets bigger and badder. But I don't know. Like we talked about in the start of the podcast, it's entirely possible that if he didn't do that, then the realm never would have recovered from its bloodshed and turmoil, and they would yeah. be, you know, the Westeros, instead of having 20 good years, would have been a real shit show. I don't know.
Yeah. I think it's a little more weird that he keeps a lot of the Kingsguard and stuff. Like, the people who are immediately surrounding him, I think that's a little more strange than letting some
deal.
Lords kind of rule their lands.
Like if you embrace Tywin, then what, you're going to exile Jaime and piss him off? You're going to refuse to marry his daughter and piss him off? Like, he's your most important ally
right.
at this point.
Right.
And also, because that's the other thing, is like, you ask, like, what Robert... I don't think Robert wanted a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Robert wanted to kill and drink and fuck. And
yeah.
he had Ned on one side saying...
kill Targaryens.
And he had Ned on one side saying, hey, we should at least exile Jay. We should at least strip him of his white cloak. And he had John Iron saying, well, that'll piss Tywin off. And he had Robert saying, well, I like Tywin because he came in and killed a bunch of Targaryens. And, you know, that saying what he wanted to do as far as statescraft is so weird to me. Because, yeah. It seems the only thing he was really passionate about was killing Targaryens.
Mm-hmm.
Because in his mind, they kidnapped and raped his beloved betrothed.
Right.
So, I don't know. I don't know if that helps any, but that's my view. Gwyn says, Aeron, every time you've mentioned the match between Loras and the Mountain, you talk about the Mountain's horse being in heat or some variant thereof. Mm. In the books, and I think in the show, Loras intentionally rides his mare, who is in heat, in the tourney, knowing right. Gregor Stallion will lose his dick, or rather his head over it. Yeah, if I said that, it's because I have some kind of weird verbal dyslexia, because I knew that, but I just fucked it up. So,
right.
Bonus question. I cannot stand Roy Dotry's narration of A Song of Ice and Fire. His voice in general irritates me, and listening to him talk sex scenes makes my skin crawl. I cannot for the life of me tell if y'all's nods to him are sarcastic or just people being into different shit.
I think it's people being into different shit. I do like his reads of it. I'm with you, though. I can't stand him reading a sex scene.
I would love to see...
And it's not just because he's reading it, but how it's written, too.
I was going to say, could you get Antonio Banderas in here and have him read that and everybody be like, oh, yeah, Mirror Swamp, fat dick mass. I'm getting hot over... I just think that shit is really poorly written.
Yeah, it's baked into the material. I don't think Dotry's going to fix that.
But here's the thing, Audible's not sponsoring this particular week. I do like their service, but my confession is, I've never liked audiobooks.
Okay.
I don't like being read to. I always find that their pacing is off, or they don't. I remember, there's rare exceptions. I think the guy who does, I think it's Richard Tull, who does the Patrick O'Brien series, is like, okay, he was put on Earth to read these books to me. But I really hated the Harry Potter ones. Especially the guy, there's this particular guy who just, his Hermione is like, oh, Harry, oh, Ron, Harry, Harry. And I'm like, oh, fucking Christ, how can you, that's your first, only, and last take of that. Roy, he's a little slow for my taste, but the thing about the Audible is, you can speed him. That has solved almost all my problems with the book narrations.
Yeah.
I start out 1.25x and he's really getting he's reading Game of Thrones the way you need to read Game of Thrones. So that's why I like Audible and not books on tape or books on CD, because I can control all that.
Right.
Again, I'm not getting paid for saying this. This is a genuine plug for service I use, and it's instrumental for me. I read three of the Game of Thrones books in the off season once, which I guess is that super impressive?
I think so. They're big books.
I think it was even more. It's something because me and Mad Brew went. I think we started on season two, or no, something. I can't remember. But there's I only had a very short off season to do it, because of the way we did the beginning of the podcast, and the only way I was able to do that was using Audible service. This was before they even sponsored us, and that's when I figured out the trick of speeding them up. So I like him. Plus. He was in the show in the future season. I think that's cool. And he's just always been Martin's guy. So it's no accounting for taste.
Word of caution to people who only listen to the audiobooks, though, is he says some words with a very British accent. Mm. And they're not at all written how they sound. And if you're American, you wouldn't pronounce them that way.
Yeah.
And when you have discussions with other people who've read the books,
right.
And you say... Dawn instead of Dorne.
Yeah,
they're gonna look at you like, what the fuck, man.
He also there's controversy because I guess he pronounces some names and places,
yeah,
quote unquote wrong,
yeah,
whatever that means. And sure. I'm the last guy to pillory a person for that. Anyway, that's a whole bunch of bullshit no one cares about. Cherie from the UK just wanted to point out that Loras Tyrell is actually Renly's squire, so it would make sense to the outside perspectives that their relationship is intimate, so to speak. It's actually Loras's job to service Renly. Har har. Mm. I forgot that detail, and at first I'm like, that's bullshit. And I looked it up, and sure enough, it's well attested to that he's at least his former squire at this point.
Is John going to be shaving Gior's chest?
Oh, yeah.
Armpits?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
I mean,
the lice up at the wall, if you're not dolphin smooth,
right?
You're not really playing the game.
I wonder how he got the reputation as the bear then. Did his squire die like years ago or something?
This steward? He can go from bear to fully sprouted in a fortnight. That's the thing.
From bear to bear?
Yeah. It's his barrel cycle is just so rapid. Has nothing to do with the seasons or the solar. It's just him being all man. Okay, that's all we got for the non-spoiler feedback. Again, Game of Thrones at baldmove.com or forums.baldmove.com if you'd like to submit some feedback, and then we will get into the spoiler section. This is where you need to get out if you've not listened past or watched past this episode.
You got like 10 seconds of music to do that. So if you're out on spoilers, check out now. If you're in on spoilers, listen to the music, and we'll be back. Until next week, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See you.
And we're back with the spoiler section. What's going on? I've got one thing that I want to talk about.
Just the pathos of Jaime Lannister, because we talked about how Tywin is doing this like carrot stick approach, and he's like, become the man you're always meant to be. We know that he rides off, meets the young wolf, and is captured very early on in the campaign. And you got, and that's the state we find him in, and then he's in prison, and then he's, you know, loses to a woman, and then he gets his hand cut off. Like, there's a lot that really set up his subtle character shifts. Like, what a blow that must be to have this much trust placed into you by your old man. It's the flip side of Tyrion, who was made Hand of the King and, like, crushed it, and then was yanked away from them. Jaime was handed half the kingdom.
Couldn't do anything with it.
And he just happened to run off against one of the best young military minds, fighting with a bunch of berserker Northmen with a direwolf. And in his land, he got captured, and now he's... Jaime's a very complicated guy.
Yeah, and then, you know, as much as I don't want to say this about a nobleman, somewhat of a victim of circumstance. I mean... You know, he's got all the advantages, but a lot of this stuff that's happening is, you know, even down to his love for Cersei, it's kind of like something he can't control.
And that's the thing, like, Jaime wanted to be the knight that Brienne is. Like, that's why he joined the Kingsguard, because that's what he always wanted to be. Like, that's what the best knights, most virtuous knights did, and then... He served for a madman and then a drunk. I mean,
that's not his fault.
No. You know, I don't think that excuses you shoving an 8-year-old out of the window.
Right. Sure.
But there's, you know, he's a complicated guy. I have another point. What did you have?
So there's a scene where Jorah's handed a royal pardon, right?
Right.
Now, presumably that comes from Robert. Because Robert is the king who would have sent it.
Sure. He at least signed it anyway.
Yeah, he at least signed it and stamped it. How does this work out for Jorah if he comes back and says, hey, I got this royal pardon. Oh, what? Robert's dead and Ned's on the throne? Oh, shit.
Right.
That's bad news.
Yeah. Now, Ned would actually honor it, I think.
You think so?
Because he's a law and order kind of guy.
Even though...
Like, I didn't agree with that.
It's a dishonorable thing that Jorah did.
And I got my eye on you, but pardon's a pardon. The more interesting question is, what does anyone else do in that situation? Like, if Littlefinger is on the throne, or Varys is on the throne, or God forbid Cersei's on the throne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, currently, I guess Joffrey's on the throne.
Joffrey is on the throne.
So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder... You know, what would have happened if he acted on that?
I don't
know. Now that we're in the spoiler section, I can say, hey, he doesn't go back.
I guess my other point was that, you know, if we take Littlefinger at his word, he doesn't love Cat anymore, which I already talked about in a non-spoiler section, so I'm not sure why.
Right.
Now, I think a lot of questions we had about, you know, what does he feel about, like, has he transferred any of that to Sansa? Is his love, quote unquote, for Sansa just yet more revenge on Kat? Like, yeah, she's attractive and she's hot and she's young. But on the other hand, boy, it'd really stick it to her mom if I made her fall in love with me and she was my queen and I killed her father and I betrayed what was, you know, like, it's like, how deep does the pathos of Littlefinger go? Like, is he, I just don't see him as a man capable of feelings like love.
Yeah, but I also don't see him as like a man interested in a sort of revenge.
Really?
No.
Man, it seems from his speech this episode, that's kind of was a formative thing. Like, yeah, I realize I can't win in this way, but I want to fuck these guys and girls
really?
In Cat's case.
Yeah, I guess I didn't take the like getting even sort of thing back. It's just like a lesson he learned about how to get the things he wants.
Right.
Which I view much more as his goal. Just like, I'm going to get the things I want regardless of, you know, who I have to fuck over or whether I'm getting revenge or anything. Like, above all, he's looking for power and wealth. Yeah.
It could be a linguistic thing. I just think, like, if you say mm-hmm. I have to beat someone, like, that doesn't imply any disrespect or feelings like, hey, like, you know, like, there's a noble opposition. Like, I have respect, but, you know, I'm on this side, they're on that side. They have to be defeated, whether it's politically, militarily, rhetorically, whatever. You say, I'm going to fuck that guy. That implies a little bit of malice and hostility and lack of respect. And that's the language he's using.
Did he? Oh, okay.
Yeah, he's like, I can't beat them at their game. I'm going to fuck them. And you know...
In the context
literally,
of that scene,
that's like, I'm a whoremonger and whatever. But right. I also think that there's a little bit of that anger there, too.
Okay.
Shall we get the feedback?
Yeah.
All right. Hannah H. is up first. She says, I'm listening to your recaps and the most recent episodes, and I've always been thinking, what are Bran's feelings about a situation? We always see him in the show being dragged around by Mira, etc. In the first season, he's clearly upset and annoyed by being left by his mother and father. This feeling will only grow in time that he is an outsider. What if, when push comes to shove, he doesn't side with his family and sides with the outsiders who have been put in a situation out of their control, which he saw with the flashbacks? Love to hear your thoughts. So this is a somewhat common theory of Bran being kind of like a Dark Lord character. You think he's going to be the savior, he's going to be important, but actually he has to be defeated because he's justifiably consumed with disappointment and alienation. And like, you know, like in The Watchmen, how Dr. Manhattan slowly loses his humanity when he's granted these fantastic supernatural powers. Like, could that not happen to a man who talks with trees and sees the future and the past? And
yeah, I don't see why not.
Where do you come down? Like, how on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being preposterous and 10 being a moral certainty, where do you come down on Bran becoming an evil Dark Lord type of character?
I'm that's pretty low on my
not even like you're not neutral like
list.
A 5, you're like,
nah, it's more like a 2.
Ooh. Well, okay.
I guess I'm holding out hope for
the Dragon Rider theory.
I'm in general with Game of Thrones a pretty standard story, in that the people you perceive to be good or the people you like win generally. I'm holding out hope for a positive outcome for the realm.
Yeah.
And I don't view Bran being a bad guy as a very positive outcome.
Right. Well,
that might be on me. I mean, I might be setting myself up for disappointment, but
yeah. Yeah. And there's like, I mean,
but
there's a
storytelling
of...
mechanic, and that's a pretty big part of it.
So everyone agrees that the idea of like John and Danny getting together and ruling as husband and wife, king and queen, Song of Ice and Fire, yada, yada, that's probably too Pollyanna.
Okay.
I wonder if you could sour that just slightly by having John having to defeat Bran. Because, you know, there's a lot of foreshadowing. Like, I think it's Maester Aemon who says, like, love is the death of duty to him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you can't do, and, you know, clearly he has love for his little brother. You know, he talks about meeting him again sometime. There was a significant moment where Bran got to see Jon, and Jon didn't even know it when they're up there in Craster's Keep. That would be a way to make that ending that we all think is too saccharine palatable if John has to do something truly awful and some soul searing to win.
It'd be like Luke killing Vader.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. So that, I think that would be kind of cool. The other thing is like, on the other hand, the other popular theory is him being a dragon rider where he's like mentally able to control a dragon and ride in that kind of manner, which I always thought was kind of cool until this season. It seems like Danny can just whistle and they all come running.
Sure.
So, anyway, there's our thoughts, Hannah. Thomas T. says, of course, Jorah didn't start out spying on Danny. He started on spying on Viserys, a person incapable of inspiring loyalty. Danny wasn't a factor in it. She just became the primary threat. And once that happened, Jorah changed pretty quickly. So we talked about that. I just wanted to give Thomas credit for, because I'd, I never really thought about it that way, you know? Mm-hmm. And I wonder why Jorah couldn't articulate that. Like, I wasn't spying on you, I was spying on your brother. Can you blame me?
Right.
Like, that's never been, like, this is all subtext I think Thomas is right about, but, like, I don't know, would that carry, it's like, look, the very first time that I could have really betrayed you for real, I didn't. So, mm-hmm. how about you harsh all this banishment crap? Stephanie B says, today I sat down and listened to season 1, episode 5 podcast and realized there's some serious similarities between Kat and Cersei. Both women seem to act purely on emotion or seeking vengeance for wrongs done to them. Kat treats Jon terribly because Ned hurts her feelings. Kat seeks out Tyrion for an attempted murder of Bran, although the information isn't that reliable and comes from someone she hasn't seen in years and trusts only based on their shared history. Of course, Littlefinger. What follows is a shitload of misery, misunderstanding, and action before thought. Abandoning her home, her children, her duties, and northern principles for the pursuit of someone who might have committed a crime against you. Come on, Kat, you're better than that. The Tully words of family, duty, and honor don't seem to reside within Kat. It's more like vengeance before all. This characterization reminds me of someone else. Oh yes, Cersei. While I understand and appreciate the whole a mother will do anything to protect her children motive, it does leave me to wonder how far down the path Kat would have taken her quest for vengeance. Though we'll never know how she would have turned out, we do know that Lady Stoneheart cares only for revenge. In the same way, Cersei seems to consistently be blinded by her own heart's desires. She wants revenge on her father for not taking her seriously because she's a woman. She wants revenge on Robert for loving Lyanna. She took revenge on the Shame Septa with the Mountain and revenge on Margaery and the High Sparrow with her big kaboom. Had Catelyn survived the Red Wedding, would we have seen an even more vengeful and quite honestly stupid Catelyn who makes decisions based on emotions and not her intellect? If yes, is that the reason Lady Stoneheart is such a vengeful monster? What's your opinion, Jim?
It's tough because in some ways you could say Catelyn is doing all this for family. I mean, Bran lost the use of his legs. If she wants revenge for that, isn't that a form of family?
Yeah.
Now, neglecting her duties as a mother, specifically toward Bran, mm-hmm. who lost his fucking legs and needs his mom around, and a lot of the other stuff that Catelyn does kind of goes against family.
Right.
And I agree with that part of the email. I just, like, where do you draw that line? Like, because the revenge is also part of the family.
Yes. But
it's a very complicated thing.
Yeah. And I feel like that's more, revenge is more tied up with duty and honor than it is with family. You know? Because.
Yeah, I suppose so.
Is it more important to right the wrong or is it more important to comfort and protect the family you still have? And, you know, as Lady Stoneheart, right. It's interesting because it's essentially in the books, she's, if you took Kat and you stripped all of her human compassion and redeeming qualities and just left her with the things that Stephanie points out here, her vengeance and her kind of a short-sighted pursuit of such. I don't know. I want to rebel against the idea that she's the same as Cersei because right. Cersei was a point of view character. We kind of like are with her on the ride and descend into madness.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, with by the time Lady Stoneheart, we get Lady, she's not a POV character. We don't really know what's going on in her mind at all.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't know that I have any rational other than Kat is a good person and and fights for the good guys, you know?
The 8-year-old schoolyard logic.
Exactly.
But Kat's good.
Yeah, she's married to Ned. Ned was good, wasn't he? You know, it's like...
Right.
If Robert was a Targaryen, Lannister, we'd probably talk a hell of a lot more shit about him than mm-hmm. we kind of already do because he's a terrible king. So, I don't know. Interesting
yeah,
question,
it's
though.
Complicated. I do... Like, I don't want to dismiss the email and say that none of that is right, because I think it partially is.
It is frustrating, though, when you see her, like, point of view characters when she's dealing with Rob when he becomes King of the North, and she just...
Oh, yeah.
You know, because she tries to give him counsel, and some of it's good, some of it is self-serving and, mm-hmm. and self-righteous. I especially remember reading the chapter where Rob announces that he wants to make Jon the heir of Winterfell in case he dies in the battle to come. And Kat just is like, oh, I've lost everything despite all. I'm like, come the fuck on.
Right.
Like, oh, Jesus. So I don't know. She's always been on the cusp of me being able to have sympathy for her.
Mm-hmm.
TJ McSee said in 105, The Wolf and the Lion, concerning the small council debate on whether to assassinate the young Daenerys, you mentioned in a podcast that it's this fear of some far-flung future where they may or not be able to come across the sea. Will they even be able to get there? Their entire culture goes against it. They have no boats. It's like saying the Mongols would invade North America. North America? No. But there actually was a real Mongol campaign to stage an epic invasion across the narrow sea, which may go a long way to giving us a glimpse into the mind of Martin, if historical parallels between A Song of Ice and Fire and the War of Roses are anything to extrapolate from. He talks about the Mongol invasion of Japan, which is a failed attempt by the great Kublai Khai, Kublai Khan, rather, to conquer the Japanese archipelago.
Okay.
Together, the Mongols, combined with an allied Chinese and Korean force, embarked with a fleet of 4,000 ships and nearly 140,000 soldiers. The invasion stalled as the Mongol forces couldn't find a safe place to land their massive fleet. Although severely outnumbered, the Japanese defense was heavily armored and fortified the coastline. As the Mongol fleet was stuck floating just offshore, a massive typhoon, which spawned the term kamikaze, of course Japanese for divine wind, struck with such force that the entire Mongol fleet was destroyed. The Mongols suffered over 100,000 casualties and their navy was annihilated. This event marked the beginnings of the end of their great empire. It's fascinating how often that happens in history. Like, the Spanish lost their naval influence in a big fucking storm. The Persians arguably lost the long-term Greek war because they suffered a calamitous a series of storms trying to invade Greece. It's like, that's, I mean, back in the day when you had wooden ships and you're out on a treacherous sea, things can go south for you pretty quick.
It's the type of shit that gets written down in books and believed as acts of God.
Yeah, right. There are obvious parallels between the Dothraki and their real-world counterparts, nomadic horse-riding Mongols. I mean, obviously, Great Khal, Great Khan, come on.
Right.
But when you look at this kamikaze event, it all lines up so cleanly. A massive army of nomadic horsemen, plus support troops added from previous conquest, a much-needed and massive navy borrowed from new allies... Chinese, Korean ships for the Mongols, Greyjoys plus Dornish for the Dothraki, sailing across the narrow sea between Japan and mainland Asia, a clash of fighting styles where the Japanese samurai and fortified coastal positions sound just like the Knights of Westeros wearing steel dresses and stone houses. Adding to that, the weather event known as the kamikaze is thought to have been caused by a confluence of two separate storm systems, much like in the movie The Perfect Storm. Meanwhile, in Westeros, winter is coming, with some cold fronts that are going to wreak meteorological havoc on the weather systems around King's Landing. It just makes sense that some massive storm would be a feature of the seasonal transition. This is fascinating to me, because it's such a triumphant scene in the end of Season 6, but... You know, also, she was born on Dragonstone during this cataclysmic storm. We talked about that's why she's called Stormborn.
Yeah.
And, you know, Storm's End, which is the seat of the Baratheons, is also famously for being pounded by storms. She's landing on this coast that's kind of like a bit of the North Atlantic. What would your reaction be if she loses 90% of her forces crossing the narrow sea in some freak storm?
Is it a freak storm, or is it caused by the White Walkers coming south?
Is there a casual relationship there? Also, there's
Like, if it's 100% just, like, freak storm out of nowhere, I'm not certain I like it, even though, it has historical context and all that.
Is in the books, this Euron Greyjoy is said to be kind of like a warlock of the seas, and he uses human sacrifice and black magic to control winds, which is why he's able to sail around as fast as he does in the books. I wonder if that would be a book thing, like that he summons up some kind of, like after presumably his brother Victarion double crosses him with Dany and the Dragonhorn, if he gets revenge somehow by taking them out. And also that would also kind of neatly explain, like, because it seems like this is a done deal. She's going to land in Westeros and just fuck shit up.
Yeah.
Because it's so weak. Well, this would be a good way to even the odds. If there's this massive storm, she rides off with the dragons and a couple of advisors and loses all of her. But on the other hand, it also feel kind of fucking futile.
Sure. Sure. It definitely would. I mean, if she... I don't know. We talked in Fargo Season 1 about this Fishnado thing that happened that's kind of become a trope.
Right.
It's Deus Ex Machina. It's the, God from the Machine sort of thing that just comes in and changes everything, and that's that. came out of nowhere. I wonder how you feel about that, you know, given the very literal, like, connection there with the Fishnado and a storm out of nowhere taking out all these ships.
A divine wind.
Right. How would you feel about that? Because I know you were staunchly against that Fishnado.
It's all about, like, how likely things are to happen based on how fortuitous they would be to happen. Whereas, like, you know, these things do occur. Like, there's historical precedent in this universe of, like, you know, these terrible storms that afflict the... There's tons of historical precedent where not only did freak storms happen, but they brought massive invasions to their knees and changed naval powers and all that stuff. So it's like...
And I think there's a way to do it.
Yeah.
Where you can, like, foreshadow the storm a little bit.
Yeah.
And, like, they can say, hey, we're sailing into, like, the very dark clouds. You know, they're, like, people are pointing out all these obviously bad things about the storm.
Right.
And, like, Daenerys just wants to continue going because that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think there's a way to tell that story without making me feel
bad about it. I don't think, like, the Fishnado-ness of it would bother me more that, like, Jesus, six seasons, all we've wanted is for Daenerys to take a big force over across the Narrow Sea and start ruling. And it's like we finally get that moment and they instantly knock that out from underneath us. It's not the freakish and, like, implausibility. It's, like, all too plausible, but boy, I don't want to see it as a viewer.
Okay.
But man, like, I tell you, when you read the stuff that TJ lined up here, it seems like that would be just the kind of barring from historicity that Martin likes to do.
Yep.
Even with the narrow, like, man, the analogy between mainland China and the narrow and the Gulf of Japan and the Japanese mainland. That's like,
yeah, and that coalition of different, yeah, I mean, there are like four or five
new allies, like
factions
this is
in
really,
I know,
one-to-one mapping, man.
Connor
OB says, the first part of this is more for Aaron, a general question about your opinion of Gurm's writing style. Super tinfoil theories like time traveling, Tyrion aside, do you think Gurm will or should close all threads on some of the more reputable theories out there by the end of the saga? Would it be satisfying to still be able to speculate about character events, motivations, and machinations when A Song of Ice and Fire is finished? Or would you prefer everything to be wrapped up with a nice bow on top? In your Season 1 Episode 5 cast, you mentioned that most of your curious theories involves Varys' true in-games ambitions. What if that's never fully realized in the books? We know Gurm is a gardener and has this three-step reveal process, but how would you feel if some of these more nail-in-the-head theories and ideas never reach that crucial third step? Wow. First of all, you gotta question how you can draw the line between legit theories that George Martin is intending and gardening and what is just insane shit from Reddit because people are bored with not having a new book out in 5 years.
Right.
Because, man, there is a lot of really plausible stuff that Martin just like, hey, cool, but I was not really intending to go there.
Right. How much of that is true, though?
Right. Because there's actually a really cool tinfoil I want to talk about. I might do it before air the season's over that I found, like, the first one in a year that I sat up and, like, wow, analysis about Bronn and how, like, wolfish he is portrayed to be in the books. Like, there's a lot of wolf attributes to him, like the fact that his laughter is described as howling, and there's a bunch of other stuff to it, and how that might tie into the end of the books and, you know, him being like playing a crucial role in the war, which I thought was super interesting. But I could also see, like, Martin, like, I wanted people to think of him as, like, this predator, so I gave him a lot of wolfish traits, and, you know, you're supposed to feel dangerous, and it's like, what is foreshadowing and what is just, you know, trying to paint a vivid character? I don't know.
Right.
So I would say that, like, I don't know that he has to solve the mystery of Varys. Like, that could just be a fun little thing that kind of goes nowhere. Like, you know, I talked a lot about, like, real history is like that. Lots of people planned lots of shit. Most of it doesn't work out. You only hear about the stuff that does. So I don't think he has to touch on everything. I mean, honestly, like, the core, you know, Jon Snow's parentage had to be addressed. I think Dany's prophecies are the ones that I feel like have to really bear fruit. The Valonqar part of Cersei's prophecy. That shit that's like, not just reading between the lines, but this is significant. This is foreshadowing a prophecy, and it might not go down the way you think it is, but that shit has to be addressed or I'll be disappointed. The other stuff about, you know, is Varys a merman? Is Varys really a woman? Is Varys married to Illyrio and they're putting their illegitimate son on the... Like, that stuff, I don't know. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I'm surprised no one wrote in about the scene of the Mountain and the Hound squaring off in the tournament. Seeing that scene played out in the visual media is what fueled my hype for the Clegane Bowl. Granted, in the books, at the time of the possible Clegane Bowl, both Sandor and Gregor are much different physically. Sandor's injury and Gregor's zombification, for example. I always like this scene because it shows how, in a normal circumstances, Sandor would be considered a brute fighter who relies on strength and prowess to defeat his foes. But when stacked against his brother, the Mountain, who is the ultimate brute, comes across as much more calculating and skillful to be able to stand toe-to-toe with his brother and stalemate him. Thoughts? You know, I'm surprised we didn't get a little bit hyped in Clegane Bowl with that scene. We talked about it being a really cool moment, but we really didn't make that connection. I'm kind of disappointed in us, Jim.
Yeah. No, well, some things slipped through the cracks.
Yeah. So when I think about the Clegane Bowl at this point and getting over the kind of complete womp, womp, womp nature of last season in regards to that, I kind of think, like, how does that not come off as a lesser version of the Mountain and the Viper?
Sure.
Like, that's the ultimate juxtaposition of skill and nimbleness versus brute force and strength, reach versus grasp. You know, I mean, the emotion would be there. But you also had the emotion, like, Oberyn desperately wanted to get justice for his sister and vengeance on the Lannisters, and he fucked it up. Like, even knowing the little brother, big brother, burnt face nature of their struggle, is that going to be anything but a pale imitation?
Yeah, that's fair. I can't say... I can't really argue against that, because, like, as much as I would like to see the Mountain and the Hound go at it, I guess maybe for us as viewers, we feel a little more connected to the Hound than we did to Oberyn, I guess, at that time. So maybe it'll be more satisfying.
I don't know.
You don't think so?
Did you not feel really fucking connected with Oberyn when he's like, I will be your champion, and he's whipping the Mountain's ass? Like,
right, but I never knew his sister, right? So, like, I didn't know who the fuck he was really fighting for. I barely understood the implications of what he was saying happened.
Right, yeah.
So I wasn't as connected with the fight. Yeah, I liked Oberyn.
Okay.
But the Hound, I understand, like, all the complexities of his childhood.
And his long conversation with Arya and associate. We see, you know, like, one of the greatest moments is when Brienne's confronting him about Arya, and he's saying that he's looking, you know... she challenges him, like, oh, looking after her, is that what you're doing? He's like, that's what I'm doing. Like, that's, like, a real redemptive moment for him.
Yeah. He's had just moment after moment where I've been impressed with the Hound.
Like, you think if he was born in a different family and a different, like, he might be, like, Sir Duncan the Tall reborn or masculine version of Brienne of Tarth.
Right.
But he didn't.
So maybe it'd be satisfying in that we're more interested in that character's conflict.
Right.
Or at least I am. I can't speak for everyone.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, we get so few really badass sword fights. Like, you got Ned and Jaime, but that was kind of like an asterisk. Jaime versus Brienne, but, you know, Jaime was handcuffed. Brienne versus the Hound. We got Ned versus Sir Arthur Dayne.
Yeah.
Like, you hear about a lot, like, you know, you always this big Titanic Robert with his big ass Warhammer versus Rhaegar Targaryen caving. You always hear about all these badass things and you don't ever see them. Like, so I'm like, I kind of would like to see these, like, tanks go at it. That would be kind of cool in a very Pacific Rim kind of way. Like, these giant hulking metal things smashing in each other would be cool. All right. Any other thoughts?
No.
Jeff W., on episode 105 of the podcast, you guys discuss your confusion over the show Varys' involvement in the plot to assassinate Dany, i.e. why risk killing Dany if he's secretly plotting to put the Targaryens back on the throne? I think his actions are totally consistent, but just not obvious. That would be consistent with Varys' MO, I would say.
Yep.
Varys has seemed to arrange the assassination since he was instructed by the king and the small council, but he doesn't want to assassinate Dany since he is secretly plotting to put her back on the throne. He also can't be caught sabotaging the assassination plan, so he sends a message to Jorah hardening him. He knows this information will tip off Jorah about the assassination since he would only be pardoned if his spying duties were complete. Though Varys' spy network, he knows that Jorah is forming a connection with Dany and therefore correctly assumes that Jorah will take this information to prevent the assassination. I wouldn't be surprised if Varys also had a backup plan, but his first method is much smarter because there is no direct connection between him and the prevented assassination. For proof, if you think about it, why would Varys send that message to Jorah? The best way to ensure the success of a secret plot is to not give anyone any hints of his existence. If Varys truly wanted Dany dead, it was sloppy of him to pardon Jorah before the deed was done. How does this strike you?
That I think is fair.
I think his analysis is right on, but mm-hmm. I wish there was something would show that he had a backup plan because it's also incredibly risky.
It is.
Like, what if
it relies entirely on Jorah's mental state at the moment?
Which I do think that he probably did have little birds and he probably was aware of mm-hmm. their closeness of the relationship and, you know, but I don't like if this is central and a central thing that he was trying to put the Targaryens back on the throne. It's a big roll of the dice. But I kind of think this analysis is right on. This is exactly what we're supposed to understand.
Okay.
Dasha says, can you explain, please, if Arya killed the Freys and his, or Walder Frey and his sons, does that mean the twins now belong to Edmure Tully because he was married to his daughter? And what about Riverrun? If so, does that mean that the whole of the North will now unite against King's Landing? Well,
doesn't Frey have those other two kids? Doesn't he have a bunch of kids?
Well, the two ones that he was primarily talking about and antagonizing and was commanding the forces sieging Riverrun are the ones that Arya baked in the pie.
Right. Shit.
So
he doesn't.
I mean, he's got like shit ton. Like we've seen he's got like 40, 50 kids and in the books are always squabbling and they keep track of who's in line and like, well, you're fifth or I'm eighth. And but they're also like you think that the two eldest are probably the most capable and they just got baked. So I kind of feel like they're done now.
So Edmure can only run one castle, right?
Right.
So he's got to pick. And whether he wants Riverrun or...
I would take Riverrun and put your most trusted lord in charge of the twins.
Yeah. Would that be a Frey? That would be a Tully.
No, I'd get the Freys the fuck out of there. There's lots of bannermen in the Riverlands that he could elevate or whatnot. But it's got to be really nice knowing that... Because Frey's been such an asshole and he's absolutely crucial. He's got this chokehold of this important chokehold. A strategic location. Uh-huh. It'd be so nice to get the phrase out of there, honestly.
Yeah, no, I'm all for it.
Like, it's like the thing with the Boltons. Like, if Ned could just, like, say, okay, Boltons, you're out of there, I'm sure he probably would have because they've always been kind of the, you know, evil vampiric side of the righteous North. But, I don't know exactly how it'll come out, but I think the analysis is right on. The other thing is the Riverlands are not part of the North. They're still... The only thing in the North is the North. Everything else is the South.
Okay.
So the Tullys were not bannermen of Ned. They just sided with him because he was married to their daughter, and that was part of the coalition with the John Arryn, who's also not a bannerman. That's the Vale is its own mountainous territory.
Okay. Right. So
David from Melbourne says, on a note about the Lannisters' hair color, I always took the darkening of Jaime and Tyrion's hair as a sign of them losing their Lannisterness. Jaime's hair starts to get dark when he is a captive and with Brienne, gets a little bit lighter when he's back in King's Landing with Cersei, and then darker again when he leaves her. Tyrion starts off super blonde, then gets darker and darker, particularly after the Blackwater, and is just straight up brown for the last few seasons. Cersei, Joffrey, Marcella, and Tommen, by contrast, all have blonde hair until the very end, signifying they're always Lannisters. I'm not sure if it's intentional, but that's the thought that I had. What
do you think? Tyrion went through an emo phase, got real dark there for a while.
With him and the beard, he's just the Blackbeard the pirate at this point.
Yeah.
I guess if I squint, Jaime has kind of like dirty blonde hair this season. Whereas I do remember once, as soon as he gets taken captive, like they just fucking, he's like, nope, no more. I'm not lightening my hair. Fuck you guys.
Then he just has dirty blonde hair. It's just real dirty.
Yeah, I and then when he gets his little Caesar cut, it's like super dark. I guess. I still think it's weird that you're like people refer to him as a golden haired Lannister to his face, and he's got his hair as dark as yours, man.
The real question is what color is Varys' hair? And until I know the answer to that, I don't know where his loyalties lie.
And does the carpet match the drapes?
No, I don't know. But maybe he shaved his head.
It's all hardwood floors, top and bottom.
God. Yep.
Just smooth veneer. Could be
a Lannister in disguise.
Shit, man, there's so many Varys's, a secret Targaryen, and
right.
Based a lot on this. I mean, I did a whole podcast on Varys theories way back. If you look in the spoiler archives, you can find those. And they're fun, and I don't know how plausible they are. Chang K mentions, you mentioned in passing that Cersei ordered a massacre of Robert's bastards. However, we're shown in season 2, episode 2, The Nightlands, when Tyrion realizes that it was Joffrey and not Cersei who ordered the massacre. Yeah,
that's in the show. Okay.
Yeah. Huh. Now, I don't know if that's conclusively. I can't remember if that's something that Tyrion figures out in Cersei's presence and. That that is theory, or do we know for sure? But I do remember that when mentioned. Man, I got to give it up to the Double D's because we talk about some of their gaffes and some of the plot holes and stuff like that. But it's got to be a bitch to keep all this stuff straight. I mean, all I'm doing is podcasting and reading about it, and I do unforced errors like this. So part of it is just I can't talk right. But yeah, that's just I've forgotten about that. Troy C. And you know that also tracks clean because Joff was genuinely outraged at his accusation. I could see where he'd be like, fuck all these I'm gonna kill them all. I'm gonna be the one true son of my daddy.
Right.
Because that's the other thing. We found out that
Except for the other two sons of his
daddy. But Joff actually has genuine feeling for Robert. That's the other thing one, I got. Didn't you get that in this episode?
Yeah.
He's genuinely distraught about his dad dying.
By his bedside, sure.
So that kind of leads credence to the theory that he killed Bran as a way to weird way to kind of get in with his dad.
That he tried to kill
Bran. Tried to kill him, I thought those are all interesting shades of his character. Troy C., and this is the final email. I had a thought that I'm really surprised that you or your listeners have not brought up in a spoiler section of this season yet regarding Ned's refusal to have Dany killed. He lists a bunch of good reasons in the show, but could Ned's actual motivation to be that he does not want to eliminate members of Jon's family? When thinking about Targaryens, Ned must inevitably think of Jon too, right? Could his refusal to have Dany killed be out of love or loyalty to Jon and the off chance that he ever gets to meet the rest of his family? I'll go further and say that I don't know if it's that, but I do think that whenever he sees Robert going crazy to kill Targaryens, that it triggers Ned's PTSD and like if he ever found out about Jon, this is all going to happen in my family.
That's a good point. And Ned promised to tell Jon about all this shit when he got back. So he comes back and says, "Oh yeah, by the way, I voted to kill your cousin at that
aunt,
point.
I think
your aunt.
Yeah,
he might not be happy about that.
Yeah, and I am kind of disappointed myself because I know. That thought was somewhere in my mind. It'll be interesting when you see Ned's passionate defense of Daenerys, and now that we know that he knew that this was Jon's blood relation, and this is essentially the same stuff that he would say about Jon, his nephew. That does give an extra poignancy to those scenes. This isn't just him talking about right and wrong. This is a personal matter to him.
Sure.
Why do you have the hard on for the Targaryen children, man?
That's interesting. I had never even thought about that.
So another quick note, Master Aemon is a Targaryen, so he must be related to Jon too. Could you intelligent gentlemen spell out for your listeners how they're specifically related within the Targaryen family? Oh shit.
Aemon's 300 years old.
I copy and paste his email and I don't think I got this last paragraph. So I'm going to, I think that the Mad King is Aemon's brother.
Okay.
Which means that Rhaegar was his, and all that, the royal family is his niece and nephews, and the children are murderers' grandnieces. And I remember there's a scene coming up where, you know, Rob calls his banners and becomes king of the North and John wants to leave. And Aemon says about, like, the times that he was tested, and he gets really worked up and emotional talking about being up in the wall and hearing the usurpers killing his, you know, nieces and grandnieces, or maybe it can't be grandchildren because he didn't have any. But I think that Daenerys would be his grandniece, which would mean,
and John would be his.
It was also grand nephew.
So he'd be his great uncle.
Yeah,
like John's great uncle.
They're both, because he's still like,
right. Yeah,
these are all the, you know, these are like Daenerys is John's aunt, which means that to, you know, her father's brother, it's still, that's still like great aunt and great uncle territory, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, family tree is hella confusing. Mm-hmm. Now, Aemon's old enough that he actually might be like one generation older, but I don't think so. I think him and the Mad King are...
If he's the uncle of the Mad King, oh, holy shit.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, he is like 102 years old at the start of this whole thing.
Yeah.
So I will look that up, and if I'm wrong, I'll have a retraction. I'm sure I'll have like a half a dozen emails correcting me anyway. But if that's wrong, but that's how I think they're related.
You know what? If I were, I don't know, Ancestry.com, I would be doing a campaign. I would have like, go look up the great uncle of John. I would be like, doing a whole campaign around this right now.
Oh, shit. He is the uncle, long forgotten uncle of the Mad King. I just looked it up now.
So he's a great, great uncle?
Yeah. So just put another layer of generation in between it, and there you
man.
Go. Man. Because every time we see the Mad King, he's fucking super old, and he's got like the really long face. I mean, that's the thing.
Looking like Walter Frey.
He might not even be that old, because it's kind of like, you know, in The Aviator when Hughes starts losing his mind. He's got the long fingernails and the beard. Like, he's just scraggly, and that plays as old, but he's not actually that old. So there you go.
Right, because they also have the white hair. So it's like,
true.
What the fuck? How old are you, man?
Right, yeah. Are you 20? Are you 80? What's going
Cut
on
your
here?
Fingernails, I need to know.
All right, so there you go. That's all we have.
All right.
Game of Thrones at baldmove.com if you'd like to send us feedback, or to forums.baldmove.com if you'd like to talk with your fellow fans.
All right, well, we'll see you guys next week.
Yeah, next week's going to be... Is that...
I think it's Dungeon Ned, and then the following week is...
I think Ned might get executed next episode. Like, I genuinely don't remember whether the hammer falls in 8 or 9.
Me either.
But there's lots of shit, man. There's going to be so much. Like, one thing is, I know some topics are so here's some topics for advanced discussion. Jon's a Targaryen, gets his hand burned. What's up with that?
Oh, shit.
The other thing is, if whites can't cross the wall, and we've seen what it looks like when a white crosses one of these magical thresholds, they just explode. Mm-hmm. How the hell does a black brother who's a white come under the wall and reanimate and try to kill the Lord Commander?
Good
plot
question.
Plot hole, or is there a magical explanation for it all?
I'm sure there is.
But next time,
we'll know in a week.
Game of Thrones, the podcast.
All right. See you guys.
Bye-bye.